Hi, good evening, everyone. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, March 5th, 2018. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. Eastern till midnight. If you're listening live or over another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 515-604-9386. Participant code is 419-303. Our website, nationallibertyalliance.org, and you can click on the weekly call on the top left side to get more information. If your cell provider blocks or charges for the call, you can call our backup number at 781-838-3728. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions@nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support National Liberty Alliance's effort to save America. Also, please support National Liberty Alliance by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab on the top right side of our website. Okay, just real quick about the donation. You know, I started sending some email out specifically to our administrators. We have a lot of administrators. If all the administrators were to give a $5 donation, we'd be pulling in quite a bit of money. There's so many things we could do. Of course, if all of our members were to give a $5 donation, you know, weekly, that's giving up one cup of coffee and a, you know, a roll or a bagel or something a month. Just give up one cup of coffee and a bagel a month. And that's $5 a month. We really need the support. We need the support from many different directions. We need people to volunteer their time, work on our committees. We need people to build committees of safety in their county. We will instruct and help and assist anyone in any way we can to help that. We've got a book, how to create a committee of safety in your county. Just click on the COS button on the top bar. And you'll get all the information you need. We've got some videos and instructional stuff and information about committees of safety, and like I said, it'll be PDF and also videos. And again, look, we have so much to do. We are in a great position. We have filed the grand jury has come together, and we have filed another indictment. We went after big names on this indictment. If you haven't seen it yet, you can go up to our website, nationallibertyalliance.org, and highlight the grand jury and click on docket. And you come down towards the bottom there, you'll see the indictment we filed. And it has been filed in the court. You can go up on PACER and find it. It is in the court. We are under the auspices of the court. They have a duty to take our paperwork, and they have. I know the judges were trying to get rid of it. I believe the clerks decided that they're not going to go to jail for the judges, and they probably left it up to the judges to remove it, and I don't think they're that stupid to remove it. So it's going up there. We are also, by the way, can we mute some mics out there? But we are also going, we're going to be looking at 9/11 soon. So we have all the information for potential indictments up there on 9/11. We need to find our targets. I got some people in mind. I'm sure others do too. And let me mute his mic. Okay. And so, you know, we have a committee, I believe. Jan, am I correct that we have a small committee going through things and laying out the different targets for the 9/11 consideration of indictments?
Yeah, we're working on it. We've got about three people right now working on it. We could use a couple more. That one document is like 200 and some pages long.
Okay.
There's a lot of digging.
Yeah, a lot of things to go through, and let's find our targets. We need to make sure that they write a paragraph, not a paragraph, a couple of sentences concerning what it is, how they participated in that crime. This was really a terrible crime. I think it was almost 3,000 people died in the towers alone. I think, is my number correct? About 2,900 or something, or 800?
It was over 2,500. I don't remember the exact number.
Okay, so it's up there pretty big. And, this was an inside job. This was, you know, people who claim to be us, our leadership in high places. I'm not going to mention any names at this point in time, but I know a lot of people have some ideas and some names. And it's pretty sick that they have killed these people. Men, women, and children died in that thing, and they really couldn't care less. I am convinced on what took place down in Florida that this guy that they arrested for that shooting, where I think it was 17 kids were killed, I don't believe he's guilty. I don't believe he had a clue on what's going on. This kid was probably so drugged up from pharmaceuticals, probably by his doctor or somebody, I don't know. But in any event, he just seemed to be out of it, didn't know anything about it. And then I saw a video I'm sure a lot of people have seen where five officers were denied access into the school, was told to stand down, to stay out, and they stayed out for quite some time. I know one of them quit. They resigned. They probably lives were threatened. And there was a helicopter. I guess it was a news helicopter. I really don't know what it was. I don't know how many people saw this film. But this copter was flying above the school and taking video, and before the police actually came and made access into the building, there was a vehicle there with three or four individuals coming out with heavy gear, throwing into the back of a truck, and I presume the truck pulled away at that point. I didn't get a video past that point. And then, of course, there was a witness talking about someone that was in there with full hard gear. I mean, not only what kind of a person would kill kids, go into a school and just shoot up kids. I mean, that's sick as it is. But an American, and if it is us, the deep state, trying to move, you know, the people to go up against our Second Amendment and so on, and this is their purpose and this is their reasoning, you know, we got some serious problems here. And we need to look into this. So maybe that's something we can get some people who might want to search the internet and see what kind of news they can get on this. Witnesses, pull some witnesses together, get their video comments on it. We don't need to personally, you know, interview them, but we can get comments on this. We can get maybe news stories of people interviewed telling their story, making the point that this was an inside job, that this was a situation by the deep state and not by some crazy kid who's just lost his marbles, you know. So anyway, anybody who could dig into that and start to gather together information and get it to us, we definitely will look at it. But anyway, we have the 911. I also put some information up there on the IRS. I think it's time to go after them, and it's on the ATF. These people are really out of control. And so there's information on that. We're going to be seeking out indictments on that also. We have I don't know if it's a 2 or 3 hour video. I think it's called America, Freedom to Fascism. It's all about the IRS trying to get information. Very well done documentary. And it goes, and there's lots of names in there. We want to put a committee together on that, Jan, too, who can go through that video information and start getting names. After that, we have a link with more information that links to another place on our website, which is the Road to Continental Congress 2009, I think it's named. And what that was all about was coming together as the Continental Congress, but the question that started this whole thing was the question about the 16th Amendment and the law that requires income tax to be collected, and so on. And this was done by We the People. Robert Schultz is the founder of We the People, and so he really put a lot of this stuff together. And they did a really good job going through the law and the processes to show that this is a con job to collect money. But anyway, we're going to consider going after the individuals there, too, in the IRS and the ATF. ATF, Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, which is one and the same, by the way. They wear the same hats. But in any event, those are things we need to get busy on. There's a lot of other things we need to do. We need to sue the judiciary. okay, for robbing we the people of our Article III courts and replacing them in administrative court that you can't even tell which way they're really coming from, and they even don't even keep their own rules and laws and statutes. But anyway, we need to deal with that. And again, all this stuff costs money to do. We have other cases we'd like to pursue. We are pursuing the gun case here in New York, and it's in the federal court, so this will be a national decision anyway. And there's a few other things. And there's a lot more that I'm sure we could dream of that we can do, but we lack the funds. I mean, we're scraping at the end of every month, the beginning of every month, shall I say. Like right now, we're scraping the bottom of the barrel, trying to pay bills, keep the lights on, so to speak, and move ahead. And at the same time, hoping to get a few extra bucks so that we can, do more and file cases and really get down to do the business of what we're here to do, which is to deal with this subversion against we the people, subversion against the United States of America, period. A direct assault upon our Constitution, a denial and a refusal of obedience to the law of the land, a denial, a refusal of obedience to the law that we the people ordained and established, called the Constitution for the United States of America. And I had an email from someone, and they thought that from the email I kind of got the idea that they were confused on the idea that in 1877, which I think was 1871 actually, but the Organic Act of 1871. Somehow took away our government and replaced it with a corporation. Nothing could be further from the truth. It's an impossibility, could not happen. The only way it could happen is if you believe it's happening. Reality is the way one perceives it, and if the people believe that that's the law and that's the case and they want to shrug their shoulders and give up, well, then, you're going to get what you get. No. They didn't have the power. They didn't have the authority. There's no way any group of individuals within our government can stand up and change the Constitution. They don't have the power or the authority to do it. They can't do it through legislation. They can't do it through courts. Now, I know they've tried to do it through legislation. It's null and void. I know they've tried to do it through the courts. People don't realize how much, but if you get in the courts and press the issue and press towards an Article III courts, you'll get it. We've been getting it. It's an uphill battle, but we'll get it. So people shouldn't give up, and people shouldn't rest in any, really surrendering to these people. These people are criminals. They're frauds. They need to hang. I don't even think they need to go to jail. They need to hang. Clearly, the people responsible for 9/11, they need to hang. Forget about jail for these people. But, of course, that's the decision of innocence or guilt by a jury when that happens, and that's the decision of the jury on what the punishment might be, but it's pretty sick. These people going into the school, shooting up our kids, I don't believe it at all. I believe this whole thing's a con job. And these are sick people, sick individuals, go and just shoot up our children. Anyway, we need to do something about it. And we do need money to do it. Everybody can afford $5 a month. Everybody. There's very few people, and there are people that are in a situation so disastrous, they've lost their homes and they're scraping the bottom of the barrel, or maybe they have to go to food places and or shelters, trying to get back up on their feet. I don't know. There are people in that kind of a situation working their way back up because the government has come in and destroyed them, and they're trying to get back up on their feet. And so, of course, there are some people that can't afford $5 a month. But generally speaking, that's far and in between. Very few people can't. Woe is us if we don't step up and do the right thing. Woe is us if we don't put our money where it belongs. And we're not asking for $100 a month, or we're not asking for $500 a month or $50 a month. We're asking for you to give us one cup of coffee and a donut, or a cup of coffee and a bagel or a roll of butter. That's all we're asking for. Once a month, just give up one cup of coffee and a roll of butter and send that $5 to us. You can do it. We need it. We're desperate for it. And we've got a large membership, and we should not be suffering as we are trying to keep the lights on and file papers and wondering, you know, and a lot of stuff we do totally in faith, you know. We'll file some papers, be stone cold broke, and just hope that the money's going to come in for the next part of the process while we're trying to pay bills. We should not be going through this. If you are not giving $5 a month and you believe that National Liberty Alliance is doing the right thing, then you should be giving us $5 a month to support this movement. I challenge right now anybody, anywhere, to find any organization that has come anywhere near to what we're doing or has a real, honest-to-true, hardcore plan to save America. We've laid our plan out. And we'll continue to lay it out and unfold some things as we go along. But we have a plan to take back the courts. We have a plan to take back our political process. We have a plan to take back the education of our children. We have a plan to keep our guns. And we have a plan to force these people to be obedient to the Constitution, the law of the land, what we the people ordained and established for them. We have a valid plan. And we are successful. You know, people think, well, what do you do? What courts this, that, or the other thing did you win? And we've won a few. We've won some big ones and on a private side of things. But look at, we've got a court case open. We are filing papers. It is in under the auspices of the courts. We are filing a copy to Jeff Sessions and the President of the United States and also Senator Grassley with the Judicial Committee. And we have a plan. And we'll look at our paperwork that we filed, especially where it comes to the indictments. We'll look at that as being, well, they're sealed for the moment. You know, we'll get, and look at, sometimes indictments go in and they're sat on for 6 months to a year. So let them sit on it for 6 months or a year. But we're going to get it done. We're now approaching 7,000 members. Not long ago, we were approaching 6,000. Now we're approaching 7,000. You know, I think we're coming very close to that point where we're going to start to hit that critical mass. That match is going to be lit and things are going to go. You know, we have this indictment, which is a very powerful indictment, and if you haven't read it, you should get out there to read it. But anyway, we have a very powerful indictment out there, and going after very powerful people. We pulled no punches. We didn't play no games. We didn't, you know, we were thinking about maybe not going after the big, but we couldn't do it. You know, my heart couldn't allow me to do it. My conscience couldn't allow me to do it. And everybody else seems to agree. And we went forward and we went after the big people. And we're going to go after the big people on 9/11. We know exactly who they are and what parts and roles they played. We know. And we're going to get it out there. And we're going to file it in the courts. And it's going to be under our filings. It's going to be under the auspices of the court. And we're going to press and press and press. But it takes the people to do it. And it takes a little bit of money. We don't need hundreds of thousands of dollars because we're not some lawyer firm. We don't need millions of dollars or hundreds of thousands of dollars. We only need a few thousand here or there. That's all we need. The widow's mite will support us. That's $5 a month. Or more, if you could afford 10 or 20, fine, or even more. A few people have. We do have a few people that give us $150 or $50 a month. And believe me, you know, that really, really helps us. Look it, if you believe in what we're doing, you need to support it. And if you believe in what we're doing and you're not supporting it, my question is why? Why aren't you supporting it? We also need more people coming to our meetings. We need to get the word out. But we also need, and everybody should be bringing a new individual every week. Every week, you know, you should invite someone to the meeting and get them onto the call and get them to participate, you know. The other thing is this indictment that we're talking about, the one for that we went after the murder of Lavoie Finnegan, and also going through the cases, the Bundy case out there and the Wildlife Preserve case and the Hammonds case, all of the judges and the prosecutors involved in that, all of these con artists and frauds. You know, we've indicted them all of them, the federal agents, the sheriff, the governor of the state. We indicted them. Hillary Clinton, and I forget the other clown's name. I think he was a senator. I think he's retired, as a matter of fact. But anyway, we indicted them all. And the papers are there, and they've been filed. And we didn't hold back. And it's up to the people to get that out. It's up to you to get it out to the press, to push those papers out. Run some copies, drop it off at the local papers, send out some emails. You send them out to websites. You know, there are a lot of people that are doing reporting on the websites, and I listen to a few different individuals from time to, quite often, actually. You know, Lionel out there, he seems to be pretty interesting, a little long-winded, but he's very funny, and he says some interesting things, but he does give a good report. And, he's a guy, get a copy to him of what we're doing. Get a copy to Alex Jones. Get a copy to SGT, anybody listens to them. There's a whole bunch of them out there. Let's get this thing out there, because this is the very thing that can cause that critical mass. People can go and see our paper, and we have the filing number for the court on there, and they can go on to PACER and look it up, and they will see our paperwork there. That gives them validity and power. So it's up to the people to get this job done. You know, one person, I can't do it, or a small group of people, we can't do it. But we're working to try to get everyone stimulated because, many hands make light work. You know, let's get out there and let's do the heavy lifting with light work, okay? All right, I kind of jumped the boat on that one because I was talking about donations. So let's move back into our regular procedure here, and then we'll go to see where we'll go from there. Tonight's scripture reading is Matthew chapter 25. We're going to pick up where we left off with verse 14. I don't know how many verses we're going to be able to read here, but I got 14 through 46, but I might try to cut that in half if I can find a place where I can break as I read. If not, we'll read all of those verses, which is about 20-some-odd verses. Let's read Matthew chapter 24. We're going to start in verse 14. Okay. Right, for the kingdom of heaven is as the man traveling into a far country who called his own servants and delivered unto them his goods. And unto one he gave 5 talents, to another 2, and to another 1, to every man according to his several ability, and straightway took his journey. Then he that received the 5 talents went and traded with the same and made them other 5 talents. And likewise, he that had received 2 talents, he also gained other 2. But he that had received 1 went and digged in the earth and hid his Lord's money. After a long time, the Lord of those servants cometh and reckoneth with them. And so he that had received 5 talents came and brought other 5 talents, saying, Lord, thou deliverest unto me 5 talents. Behold, I have gained beside them 5 talents more. His Lord said unto him, Well done, thou good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. I will make thee ruler over many things. Enter thou into the joy of thy Lord. He also that had received the 2 talents came and said, Lord, thou deliverest unto me 2 talents. Behold, I have gained 2 other talents besides them. His Lord saith unto him, Well done, good and faithful servant. Thou hast been faithful over a few things. I will make thee ruler over many things. Enter thou into the joy of thy Lord. Then he which had received the 1 talent came and said, Lord, I knew thee that thou art a hard man, reaping where thou hast not sown, and gathereth where thou hast not strewed. And I was afraid, and went and hid thy talent in the earth. Lo, there thou hast thine, that is thine. His Lord answered and said unto him, Thou wicked and slothful servant, thou knewest that I reap where I soweth not, and gathereth where I have not strewed. Thou oughtest have given, therefore, to have put my money to the exchangers, and then at my coming I should have received mine own with usury. Take therefore the talent from him, and give it unto him which hath 10 talents. For unto every one that hath shall be given, and he that shall have abundance. But from him that hath not shall be taken away even that which he hath. And cast ye the unprofitable servant into the outer darkness. There shall be weeping and gnashing of teeth. When the Son of Man shall come in his glory, well, maybe I'll cut there. I'll stop there because this is kind of long. So I'll stop there at 30, and next week we'll pick up on 31 and read through 46. Okay? You just make a note of that. Okay. All right. Anyway, that's an interesting parable that we just read because, again, it's kind of a parable to what we're doing also. You know, people who have, they need to do. And we're not asking for much. $5. That's it. Everyone, most everyone, shall I say, can afford $5. Okay, let's see. You know, we still got the constitutional sheriff campaign going on, and it's not really moving, but anybody who can help us figure a way to get a real campaign for getting money together to do this project, you know, get a hold of Jan, and maybe they can help us set something up. You know, we got a lot of skill up here on the national level and even through the committees, but we don't seem to have anyone who has the ability to be able to make money through donations and try to get a project like this going. So anybody that's got skill and ideas, get a hold of Jan. You can find him under the directory towards the top. He's a national leader for National Liberty Alliance. Okay. The New York SAFE Act lawsuit, we're still taking affidavits for that. I'm hoping to file before the middle of this month. So anybody in New York that wants to get into that, you don't need to own a weapon to get into that. Take a look. I think it's under the news. Let me go take a quick look. I think if you go to our website, nationallibertyalliance.org, and you highlight the news, and you come down, it's the third one down, it says New York SAFE Act lawsuit. New York SAFE Act lawsuit. So you can click there, and you can read the papers that we're going to file. Those papers are probably going to be filed the way it is. Of course, we'll add the names to it. We don't name names on it yet. But it's a possibility we might add some things to it. Or make a few minor changes. But generally speaking, that is what we're going to file. It's a very powerful paper. Everyone should read that paper because you can make your argument from that paper. You can show we know exactly why they want to take our weapons away from us, and we make it clear in this paper through a memorandum. And memorandums are part of this paper, so should read the memorandums too. I believe it's all attached in one document. But it starts off, of course, with the action at law is the first part of this. I think it's 16 or 18 pages, if I remember. But it's good reading. It's an education. I promise you, if you read these papers, you will get an education. Lawyers seem to have a crutch reading these things. They can't understand it because they've never seen these kind of things, and they don't believe it's the law. Apparently, they have no knowledge of our founding fathers. They don't know who Jefferson was. They don't know who George Washington is. And these are the people controlling our entire government here. You know, they represent these people. As soon as you have a question with these people, you met with a lawyer. Isn't that something? Go talk to your representative and you find yourself talking to a lawyer. And I'm not talking about the guy that's a representative that's a lawyer, and he is, usually, not all the time, but most of the time. But I'm talking about the fact you go talk to your representative, and as soon as he sees that it's something off-key that he doesn't want to deal with and he thinks is wacky or whatever the case may be, or you're face-to-face with a lawyer. And the government pays for this. All these new minions, New World Order minions, maintaining the status quo. That's what it is. We need to break through that, and we need to stop that. We, the people, did not give them permission to go out and hire all these lawyers to talk to us, because if we want to talk to a lawyer, we'll go talk to a lawyer. We want to talk to them, we're coming to talk to them. We're coming to talk to you. You need to answer. You have a duty to answer. And you're a fraud if you don't answer. The United States Supreme Court has ruled numerous times on that. You are a fraud. When you have a duty to speak and you do not answer, you are a fraud. You're guilty of fraud. You need to go to jail. Okay. Let's see. Any announcements, Jen?
Announcements. I just have a couple questions tonight.
Okay.
First question. I understand the purpose and the big picture objectives of NLA. I want to help educate others as I am learning, but I feel that it is a disservice to not also offer solutions to what can be done individually while we collectively work on saving America. That's more of a statement, I guess, than a question. Okay.
So there's no real question there?
Well, what can be done individually?
Well, look, at anybody who's got experience in law, anybody that's got experience in things that are concerning, you know, what we're doing here at National Liberty Alliance, we're looking for leadership. Step up and take a leadership role. Talk to Jen and talk about what you'd like to do or what you'd like to get involved with. And if it's a new thing, you know, Jan will bring it up before the committee, and most things we approve. I mean, hey, let's get the job done and then take that leadership role. The leaders we have, you guys need to take a bigger leadership role. Don't wait for me. Go forward. Do what you got to do. If you need an approval for something because you want to make sure that it harmonizes what National Liberty Alliance is teaching, then by all means get that to me through Jan, and we'll get that approved as quick as possible, and we'll move on. But take this leadership role, and do the right thing. And remember, you just have to, you know, do things with a sense of honor, justice, and mercy. Keeping those things in mind. Go ahead, Jim. What do we got?
Okay, the next one says, GRUs. Some speak of rescinding all contracts that assume our consent to U.S. citizen status. Some speak of coexisting in the system by correcting current contracts and reserving our rights in future contracts using UCC 1-308 autographs. Some speak of becoming secured party creditors and on and on and on. Can you recommend a source for accurate solutions?
Yeah, I can represent a great source for accurate solutions. NationalLibertyAlliance.org, right here, this is it. Look at these people put me to sleep. They bore me to tears. You know, I look at so many books and I just don't even want to read them. And I'm not going to read them. They're law books, but it's all filled with garbage and it just puts me to sleep. I'm bored, and you need a I don't know what you need to read through this stuff, but I'm not interested at all. But we have the real law, and the real law is interesting. It's fascinating. It's all about liberty. It's the Constitution. The Constitution is fabulous. We don't need to rescind any contract because I don't have a contract with anyone. The only contract I have with my government, it's found in the Bill of Rights. It's found in the Constitution. That's my contract with them. You obey that, okay? And as long as you're willing to obey that, then you can run for office and you can take a position and just be obedient. You want to negotiate it? Take a hike. We don't need you. We'll find someone else to run for office in that place. And you know what? If we don't fill offices, we'll probably be better off. It would be great if we run a term where we go to bring back a new Congress. Every 2 years, Congress goes out. Okay, it would be fantastic if nobody decided to run 1 year, so we'd have an empty Congress for 2 years. But maybe we'd have a little freedom, wouldn't we? You know. But look, we need to sue Congress. We need to sue Congress and force them and require of them that when they make any kind of a statute, that they show us where in the Constitution they get such authority. And they need to go back, and we'll list out the laws if they need us to, okay, which is pretty much all of them almost, you know. But we'll list out them if they want, but they need to go back and start reviewing the things that they have passed in the past. And let's start off with the biggie ones. Let's start off with the Organic Act of 1871. Let's start off there and then move forward. And you can't find authority to do these things. So render and put the big words, null and void. Remove them from the law books or from the statute books because they're no law at all. And we need to sue them for that. That's the only way we're going to get them to do anything. We're not going to ask them. We're not going to ask them, you know, do we have the ability to come to you and ask you questions and you answer them. No, no, no. We're going to demand show cause. You show us what you've done, and we're going to show you how you can't do it, and we're going to tell you what you need to do. And again, you know, we the people need to get into the courts and take control so that we can remove these bums from office. You know, and we need to take back the political process. And that's what we're doing with the Committees of Safety. Anybody who is not a member of the Committee of Safety in your county, you need to go out and become a member. You don't have to be a leadership role if you don't want to be. Just go to their meetings once a month or whatever it may be. And if they have it two times a month and it's too much for you, then go once a month to their meetings. Participate. Be part of the solution. And we're going to teach people eventually. Right now we're teaching them about the Committees of Safety and how to create them, get them going, make an arrangement and a connection with your sheriff and your local leadership on the local governments and start working together and lay out the rules and the plan and the framework and the foundation that we've laid up there under the COS page. We have a book, I think it's 108 pages, a book of instructions right down to, you know, all of the necessary paperwork you'll need to do with the committee. How to start it, first thing to do. We literally do this first, do this second, do this third, do this fourth. And you're structuring, okay? The Committees of Safety, the very same thing that our founding fathers used to create this nation, you are structuring back the people between the government and getting things ready. And when we get into the court systems, okay, we will show the people that are in the Committees of Safety how to become committeemen, elected committeemen, okay? And when you file your papers into the courts, I mean into the government, you file your papers to become a committeeman, okay? Once that's done, they're going to try to not recognize you, but we're going to be going to the courts to remove all of these unelected committeemen, so the elected committeemen can come and take their place. And then you'll be acting from the standpoint of as a committeeman, and the Committees of Safety will, you know, just dissolve until they're needed again. But the Committees of Safety will morph into the committeemen. That's where the real power is. That's where the real authority is. That's where they come to you, because they know who you are then. They come to you to ask you, I'd like to run for office. Will you support me? Will you give me, you know, your John Hancock? Will you walk my papers? Okay, they're going to come begging you, because that's how it works. Okay? And the way the present system works is they try to figure out how big a crook you are, because the bigger the crook, the more they want you, because the local people aren't really deciding. It's the people on the top that is deciding these things. And that's why we get all these crooks in office. We can get rid of that process. We can bring the committees back to a proper running committee, not where one man who holds the hammer rules the day. Forget that. That's BS. That person has no more power or authority than you or me. We all are equal in that committee. That man does not have, or woman, okay, does not have the power or authority to decide, well, we're not going to call this to the floor today. Maybe next week or next month. No, BS. You got something you want to bring it up, you bring it up, it gets to the floor. We need to fix Congress. This is a big problem in Congress, by the way. These committee chairmen seem to control the whole world, okay? We need to stop that. Where did they ever get these ideas from? They call themselves a democracy. This is where the democratic process is right here, what we're talking about now. We are not a democracy. We are a republic, okay? But we do use a democratic process to elect most of our, officials. And we do use the democratic process to run our committees, which means everybody's on an equal level. We're all equal, okay? We all get a vote. We all get a say. We all get a chance to talk. We all get a chance to bring up issues, to argue issues, to deny things. We all have that power and authority, okay? Robert's rules is laid out that way. Let's exercise. Okay, it's only a matter of making a motion, second a motion, and it goes to the floor, you see? Learn the process. This is simple stuff. But we need to take control of the political process. And you know what? When you take control of the political process, we're working with a group that I'm not sure exactly how this is structured, so I can't speak too much about it, but basically they're going to be approaching people who are going for election, and we want to give them sort of a constitutional test, measure them up by the Constitution, and then we would support them. we would support them in the fact that we'd say, hey, they responded properly, they understand the Constitution, and they say they're going, they took an oath that they're going to obey the Constitution, because we'll make them take an oath with us, okay? And they're gonna make their oath with God, not with me, not with you, not with the people. They're gonna make it with God, and then when they break that oath, hopefully we'll be in power by the time they get into office, then. They break that oath, we're going to pull them right out of office. Or the committee men can take them out of office. At any given time, the committee men can walk the papers, get the signatures, to yank anyone out of office at any time. 90 days, they're out of there. That's power. That's the authority. That's the consent of the people. Okay? And that's what we have to be doing. Right? So we're going to teach people how to do this on the committee man process. But you get the opportunity to quiz these people, and as I wanted to start to say here before, is we're putting together sort of an orientation for a questionnaire for these people who are running for office, and generally speaking, we're going to really give them a course. This orientation is going to be a mini course in the Constitution. They'll have to expand from there, but this way it'll prepare them to understand what kind of questions we're going to be asking them, what kind of knowledge they need to have, and what kind of promise that they're going to need, what kind of oath they're going to have to take. And if they pass the muster, they get in. Well, that's what the committee men need to be doing. And you know what? Let me tell you, with the power and the authority of the committee man, you don't even have to yank these people out of office when they misbehave. Because, you see, if you have the honest people holding them down with the chains of the Constitution, and you've walked their papers and you've brought them into office, well, then one of the chairmen goes up and say, hey, Mr. Elected, whoever you are, okay, you came to us, you asked us to walk your papers, we walked your papers, you promised us you were going to obey the Constitution. You took the test. You know right from wrong, and what you're doing here is wrong. Are you going to stop it right this minute? Because as I walk out of your office right now, we're going to the streets to walk your papers, and we're removing you from office unless you repent and change your ways and start doing the right thing. Believe me, they will repent. They will do the right thing and start walking the right way. That's government by the consent of the people. That's the power of the committee man. And if need be, we, the grand jury, you know, well, we're the administrators of the grand jury, but we can bring these people before the grand jury for a potential indictment because they're misbehaving and not being obedient. The administrators could make that phone call to that individual and say, hey, you're breaking the law. You're breaking your oath. We're going to bring you up before the full grand jury, and we're going to be seeking an indictment because you're breaking the law unless you repent and start doing the right thing. That's government by consent. That's what we, the people, are doing here at National Liberty Alliance. We also want to get back control of our education. We want to write the civics course. We want to write the constitutional course. We want to write the history courses and put it together. You know, we've already got some really great books out there that we can use as school books. All we have to do at the end of each chapter, we'll get permission from the people who put it together, and we'll talk about this in the future in more detail. But we'll put the questions in the back of each one of these chapters for a school book, for a textbook. We'll make a textbook out of these books. You know, the making of America. The real George Washington, the real Thomas Jefferson, the real Benjamin Franklin. How many people know? I'm so sick of hearing this. I hear this all day long, day in and day out, whenever I talk with people on these issues about Thomas Jefferson particularly. Oh, he's a real quagmire. He's like beside himself. You know, he was so big on getting rid of slaves, yet he owned slaves. Well, how come all the historians say this also? We don't understand what it is about Jefferson. You know, it's perplexing, you know. Are you kidding me? It is clearly in history what happened with Jefferson concerning his slaves. He had two terms in the Virginia Congress, two terms. And the very first thing he did of both of those terms was to spearhead a movement to at least allow the slave owners to sell their slaves. They could not free their slaves. It was against the law in Virginia. The only way Jefferson could get rid of his slaves is to sell them to another man, and he refused to do it. And how come the historians aren't telling us this? And when he became governor of Virginia, one of his first moves he made was to stop this problem with slavery. And he couldn't get it through. And then what does he do? He writes the Declaration of Independence, and he talks very clearly about slavery and freedom. And yet all the historians miss this. Jefferson did not want, he wanted to emancipate his slaves. That was his desire. And he couldn't do it because he'd be breaking the law, and he wouldn't be allowed to do it. His slaves would just be taken back and given to another person, okay? And he refused to turn his slaves over to anyone. That's why Jefferson had slaves. And historians refuse to teach this. It's in history. You know, go read the real Thomas Jefferson, and you will read about all this thing and the letters and what he did in the Congress there and what he did as governor and what he did as president and so on. So, you know, we got to get the true history into our schools, teach our children the truth, okay? All right, I know I went off a little bit off the path there. What else?
Hey, the next one has come up before. Probably worth readdressing. How should one handle a summons for jury duty? And I'd love to be on a jury.
Yeah, I'd love to be on one too. But well, we are on juries here, but I'd like to be on a local jury. Look, it's very simple. You know, if you want to be on the jury, go down. But tell them straight out when they ask the question. If they don't ask, don't tell, okay? But I believe in jury nullification. Boy, they're going to avoid you like the plague, and you'll never get another phone call again. It's unfortunate. But it'll solve the sorrow of getting the paper to come to become a jurist and the refuse you again anyway. But if they don't ask, don't tell. Okay, we got to believe in jury nullification, and we got to share that with the rest. And I'd be in there with a handful of pocket constitutions in the back of my pocket. And when I got together with the jury, I would tell the prosecutor over there, Mr. Prosecutor, can you leave the office? Leave us right now because we want to talk, and this is for our ears only. You don't need to hear this, okay? I'd get him out of the room, and I'd make that argument, and I'd make sure he'd leave. And then I'd give my thoughts and ideas and concerns and teach a little history to the group, and I'd pass out the Constitution and say, this is the Constitution of the United States of America, you know? And I'd pass out some literature on what Thomas Jefferson had to say and what he did concerning jury nullification. And it's all history. It's all law, okay? And then let's go now and listen to this case. And let's decide. Let's be honorable people, and let's become just people. And you know what? We need to tell the judge he doesn't get to decide the law. We'll just nullify it. We also need to tell the judge he doesn't get to decide on what the penalty is for this individual. They may want jail. We may want restitution, okay, if we find them guilty. So it's a tough thing, but that's probably the best way to deal with it. We got to do what we got to do. You know? What else?
Okay. That's all the questions that I have. I'd just like to remind people again, we could use a couple more researchers on the 9/11 evidence because we got quite a pile of data to go through there.
Yeah, and by the way, I'd like to get together as soon as possible this week, hopefully, with the group that is working on the 9/11 investigation. I'd like to see where they're at, what they're doing. Hopefully they've brainstormed together and they got a plan and they're executing it. I'd like to hear what that plan is. Maybe we got some ideas we can throw at them they might want to take on. But we do want to let them know exactly what we need. And what we need, really, is a couple of sentences, very, very specific on what this individual has done, what part did they play in this 9/11 event, And what evidence we have concerning that. And you're going to find a lot of evidence inside that video. That video is going to give you so much evidence that you're going to be able to go to Google and start running some keywords and get some written stuff and get some documents and pull this thing together. So let's do that. Let's really do a job on this. And same thing with the IRS and the ATF. You know, when you read, when you watch that video, oh, I think I was talking about this. I don't know what I went through. The there's a lot of video there that was put together by We the People. I know I was talking a little bit about this earlier. And it's all about the IRS. Now, in the beginning, there's a lot of lectures or speeches, shall I say, okay, where people come in, and they're great speeches. And some of them may not be directly related directly to the IRS problem. But it is directed directly to the individuals who are taking a power and authority because they were either elected or appointed individuals that are running these agencies, not just the IRS, but other agencies also. So there's quite a few. I think there's probably about 5 or 6 hours maybe of that kind of thing. But then after that, they do a mock trial with a huge amount of evidence, just huge. I know I've got the documents of all that. And I was looking for that, and as soon as I find it, I'm not sure where I put it. I can't find it. It's in my computer somewhere. But there's a huge amount of documents that go along with this mock trial, so to speak. And they refer to the documents, and they have number system and a letter system, so you can follow through pretty easily with them, and you can take this written PDF documents and you know, view them as they're talking or reading parts of them. And you can, you know, freeze the tape and read further into that document if you want, whatever the case may be. But as soon as I can find all those documents, I'll put them up. If I can't find them, I'll get a hold of Robert Schultz and find out where I can grab a copy of that. I'm sure he has something on his website with that. No, as a matter of fact, no, I got video. I got DVDs and with all that data on it, so I should be able to find that here. But in any event, as soon as I get it, I'll put that up there also. But we want to do something. We have to deal with the IRS. I think now is the time. There's so much stuff going on in Washington. You know, the swamp is being drained. I know from watching what's going on, there's a lot of frustration in some of the people, and I'm sure with the president too, that he hasn't been able to make his move yet to do what has to be done. Because a lot of events changes things. And, you know, here at National Liberty Alliance, we kind of understand that, you know. We have certain positions and things we do, but we know that events are going to change things, so we'll tweak ourselves this way or tweak ourselves that way to meet the event and to deal with the, whatever it is, and it may set us back on this or that. But we continue to go, you know. It's interaction. It's live. It's happening on the moment. So, you know, you execute the plan as best you can. But what I'm trying to say here is that a lot of people are going to be going to jail soon. And there's going to be a lot of stories out there that people cannot deny. There's going to be pictures of things that will make people sick to their stomach and they're going to want to throw up. And some people won't even be able to bear to watch some of the things, the atrocities that these people have committed. You know, think about it. These are the people that took down the towers. These are the people that blew up the Pentagon. Okay, these are the people that are doing all these things in the schools. Really, I don't believe for a second. I don't know that any of these people that they claim have killed these kids are the guilty party. I question it all at this point. But a few of them I know for a fact that it was the deep state that has done this and not some crazy kid or something. We need to get to the bottom of all this. We need to deal with this. But in any event, what's up next, Jan? Anything? Was that it?
No, that's the end of what I have for tonight.
Okay. Well, one other thing, you know, when we were talking a little early in the beginning about rescinding contract or correcting right contracts, remember, we only have one contract with these people. One contract. Now, you look, it is true. You go into an administrative court, it's what's called a Nisi Prius court. Okay? All administrative courts are Nisi Prius. Nisi Prius means unless first. Unless first. In other words, if you don't deny the power and authority to be able to be brought under that administration, then you are under their power and their authority, and they're going to do with you as they will. So, you know, I gave, when I went up against the employment, unemployment, what do they call that, the employment center. In any event, I went up against those people, and I rejected, I denied, I fought, I brought in the Constitution, I frustrated, I pissed them off, I did all kinds of stuff. They would just shut the court down and just go home for the day and have me come back a couple of months later. They didn't even want me back next month. I just gave them a hard time. And then they never ruled on it, and the guy, you know, eventually that was in the court, that was the judge, retired, and a year and a half after his retirement, all of a sudden some other judge just sent papers claiming I was guilty of something and wanted so many thousands of dollars. And I refused to pay it, and I didn't pay it. No one ever came out after me. I knew they couldn't. They had no power or authority over me. I rejected it all the way through. See, that's an administrative court. I didn't have knowledge back then. If I had knowledge today, I only would have went once. And I would tell them to go to hell, and then I'd take them into the Supreme Court and go after them for denying my due process, for coming after me to assault me and beat me up and take my money and do their will against me, without going through a court of law. You know, they don't have the power to take my money and take my things. It's an administrative court. So you see, with that, you contract every time you walk into administrative court and yield to them. You deny them. That's what you got to do. And by the way, town courts are administrative courts, okay? City courts, with the exception of New York City here in New York State, are all administrative courts. Village courts, administrative courts. You're there if you agreed to be there, okay? Now, it is a little touchy, and you got to be careful because there's nothing more dangerous than ignorance in action. And believe me, those judges are active, and they are certainly ignorant. And so you have to do it very carefully and deny them, and you have to decide where you want to draw your line. And, you know, if you're willing to go to jail sometimes, or if you're willing to put up the money and the time to make this battle, or just give them the $150 or whatever it is, sometimes it's just worth giving them the $150 because you got other things to do. But, you know, if you want to battle them, then you battle them and you take them into the court, you open up a court of record, and you take them into the federal court because they're denying your due process. They're acting under the color of law. They don't have jurisdiction. These are constitutional issues. That's under the federal district court. You go open your Article III court, and again, you have to be careful on how to do that. You know, if you read our paperwork, you'll all learn how to open an Article III court. The key is in the memorandums. You make your points in your action at law. You keep it clear. You make your point inside your action or something, and a conclusion of what it is, and you move to the next. But you put a little a note in there. See memorandum on whatever it is. Article III court. You make your point. This is an Article III court. You refer to a memorandum, and you give only the conclusion that the Article III court is a court of record, proceeds according to the common law. Then you give them your memorandum on that. And then you continue with your case. You keep your case nice and clean and focused without a lot of garbage in it. Any debates or arguments, you try to handle as much as you can that you know that's going to come up. I try to handle the arguments before they come up. So I handle all that with memorandums. So any case I file, I may file 6, 8, or 10 memorandums with it because that is the body, the foundation of my point, of my case, of my power, of my authority. And that's how you go into a court and keep your papers clean. And signal to the judge when you have the opportunity. You'll see when it's there. You object. Signal to the judge that you have no problem making that person a defendant in your case. No problem at all. You know. And I wouldn't say that outright, and I wouldn't write that on paper directly. But there's little things you can do and say in your paperwork that kind of gets that message out to them. Certainly, if you're going up to the federal court and you're dragging a whole line of maybe judges and prosecutors with you because they've violated your unalienable rights and you made them defendants, the judge got your message at that point. And so, you know, you should be able to get some kind of satisfaction. And 9 times out of 10, I'll tell you what they're going to do. They're going to want to make you a deal. Of course, the best thing to do is to take that deal. And taking that deal gets you out of the game. But what does for them is it prevents that case from becoming a precedence that could be used against them. And that's why they make the deal, and they'll make it very good for you. Sometimes you might want to say, to hell with them, I'm going for the precedence. That's more important to me than that. So whatever it is, I don't know, that you have to decide that. But you have to know how to do this. And again, it's an education. National Liberty Alliance provides that education. You know, we have a jurisdictionary course. If you want to take, if you want to know how to go into the courts and work the courts and fill out the papers and write the papers and what a cause of action is and what the, make sure you cover all the things and looking at the forms and what is required, what are the forms required in order to file the case, and all that stuff, okay, you'll learn that in the jurisdictionary course. Now, that course, we did not write that course. It's a course that a lot of us here took from National Liberty Alliance. I took that course to learn the process in law in the courts. And but you can take that course. It's $249. That's what I paid for it. You know, we have no control over that. But if you click the link on our site to take that course, you'll go over to the jurisdictionary site. And when you sign up, our link has a special code inside of it. It gives us credit, and they donate $50 for every course that you sign up on. So please, if you're going to go to take jurisdictionary course, make sure you sign up by clicking our link to go out there. You go out there and you come back another day, come to our site, click the link to get back out there when you're ready to take that course. So the $50 donation of your $250 will then, or $249, will then be given to us at National Liberty Alliance to fight the good fight. But anyway, that's an important course to take. Our constitutional course is important to take. Our civics course is extremely important to take. Extremely important to take. And, you know, we have some great history in that course. Great. We have Thomas Woods, a professor of law, and Boyd, you know, not a professor of history. Boy, does he teach, okay? Well, we have Michael Bodnarik in that course, teaching probably 20 hours on the Constitution. And that is a course to take, let me tell you. You know, we have Bill Thornton, okay, lays out so much stuff in the common law. We do make the point that he is in error with the king of the court. You are not the king of the court. You are at best the sovereign of the court. And again, you know, I know Brett straightened me up on this one, and as soon as he mentioned it, I knew immediately he was right on this. God is the only sovereign. But nevertheless, you know, states are sovereign, kind of a sovereign. It's a political thing. We the people are sovereign in the sense that we're above our government. So if you want to call it a clip sovereign, we both have a clip sovereignty. That's right. That could be a good way to look at it. You know, the law is written by God. The law of government and how government works is written by us. Okay, so we wrote that law. But God wrote the law. The common law, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, and gives us what is required, the punishments in different situations. And so that's the law. And all that is written in the hearts. So we kind of know it. Everybody knows killing is wrong. Serial killers know that killing is wrong. Seen plenty of interviews. They know it's wrong. They know it's evil. I can't help myself. You know, whatever the case may be, they do it, but they know it's wrong. Okay? So anyway, we provide a lot here for education, okay? And, you know, so those courses are important. And then you could take a higher education, a more advanced education. You know, you go up to our website and you go under the education tab. And you highlight the founding documents. And we got the Federalist Papers there. We got the Anti-Federalist Papers there. We got biographies there. We got state constitutions there. That's your education at that point. Education is reading. The best way to learn anything is read, read, read. You know, I'm a Bible student, been a Bible student for 40 years plus, maybe longer. Over 40 years. And I'm also a teacher, a Bible teacher. And the teacher that taught me the Bible, the best way to learn, he said, do your Bible studies and, you know, maybe even follow along with other people's Bible studies, but do your own Bible studies. But the best way to learn is read. Read, read, read. Doesn't matter if you don't understand everything. You know, it took me two or three sweeps through Brent's book, The Common Law, to really get what I really needed out of that, because I didn't have the right background when I read that book. But I had a little bit, and I was a babe. But now, you know, I went back a second time and said, whoa, I didn't realize it said that. I pulled so much meat out of there. And you go back, and I use it as a reference book, okay? And that's how all these things, Federalist Papers, Anti-Federalist Papers, use it as a reference point, as a book, reference book, to understand the Constitution. I forget which Supreme Court justice said that, said this, but if you want to understand the Constitution, you got to go back. I know Jefferson, maybe it was Jefferson, said something similar to this, or one of our founding fathers. You need to go back to when the debates were taking place and what was happening to really understand what's really going on. So if you're confused by anything in the Constitution, go into the Federalist Papers, because there's the debate, there's the conversation. There's the decisions. Read the Anti-Federalist Papers. You can't read one without the other. You got to have both point of views. You know, the Anti-Federalist Papers, Jefferson was behind the Anti-Federalist Papers. You know? But, you know, get a better education, a higher education. You know, go to our essays and lectures we have. We have American history lectures. We have common law lectures. We have trial by jury essay. We have What Happened to the Constitution essay, U.S. Marshall essay, articles, we have many, many other articles and essays and lectures, you know. We have a lot of political things, information on committeemen, how to petition to become a committeeman, Robert's Rules, Washington's Farewell Address. I mean, that anybody who hasn't read that, you really need to read that. And, you know, I read that a few times before I understood and realized he was talking about the committeemen. 50%, maybe even 60 or 70%, quite a bit of his speech was about the committeemen, okay? The power and the authority. And remember, he was a member of the Committee of Safety. He was, you know, in that process. Of course, when we got the nation, instead of becoming a committeeman, he became a president, all right? So we have a lot of stuff. We have some great U.S. Supreme Court decisions, you know, that need to be read. There are certain Supreme Court decisions everyone should read. Clearly, United States versus Williams is a decision that everyone should be reading, you know. We have, the Judiciary Act of 1789, okay? Clearly a paper that everyone should read. I mean, powerful papers, you know. Quite a few powerful papers we have up there. You know, Marbury versus Madison, which really straightens out the problems of that you will find in the Judiciary Act of 1789. Clears up a lot of problems concerning the power and the authority of the U.S. Marshals and the judges and how that whole process works. So, you know, this is your further education here. This is it. And on top of everything, and while you're doing that, people should be under the grand jury, click on our dockets page, and read our papers work. Read the papers that we filed in the court. We have filed 100-plus papers in the court. Read them, because that is an education. Cut and paste the information. Use the memorandums. Tweak them to your case, however it is that you want to use them. Cut and paste anything. You know, freely we have been given, freely we need to give back. So, you know, we need to pass this stuff around. That's why National Liberty Alliance doesn't charge anything. We decided from the very beginning we are not going to charge a penny. We've discussed the possibility back and forth, but we always ended up, nah, we can't do it. Because we didn't want to prevent the people who didn't have the money to do anything to come in, nor did we want to prevent the people from coming in. Okay, we want to give this a free education to everyone. So anything we've done is free. We do ask and beg quite often for $5 a month or more. Everybody can support that. Look at the education we've given you. We're giving you an education no college will ever give you. I don't care what university you find. I don't care what college you go to. You will not find the education in that university or college that you can get right here at National Liberty Alliance. Homeschooling, the real education. Unadulterated. Yeah, and you can come and discuss these things with us here on a Monday night. And again, that's an exercise, a sharpening of the sword. You could discuss these things in committees. you can get together. Goodness, you should get together on a local level. You know, your committees of safety, you should get together once a month to discuss these kind of things. Bring an issue up. Talk about the Second Amendment, the Fifth Amendment. Talk about the Declaration of Independence. Discuss it, debate it, argue it. Bring in the meaning of these things. Look at the Constitution. Bring in the Federalist Papers. Get the people excited on a local level, on a grassroots level. You know, without an educated grassroots level, we cannot have liberty. We cannot have a government by consent. You won't know how to consent. People don't. Look, if all of what I'm saying is new, okay, and for anybody that is new here, it probably is new, and anybody who's been around for a while, it was new to them when they first came. I know when we discovered this and started collecting all this information and putting it on our website, it was all new to us, okay? So if this is all new to you, then you have never been in a position to be able to consent to your government. You didn't have the education. You didn't know how. You didn't know what to do, where to go, who to see, or how to talk or anything. You know, we only talk as babes of what we want, what we think we want. Tweet, tweet, tweet. You know, that's it. Okay, now, okay, with your education, we come in commanding, and we are going to consent or not consent. We're going to come in with power and authority. We're going to say, you don't rule over us. You're not our masters. We are your masters. You are our servants. You know, and that's the attitude you have to have, but you have to be, you know, graceful and kind and considerate and peaceful, and an honorable and merciful and just, you know, but this is what we need to do. Anyway,
John,
is there anything else? Or can we?
Yeah. I see there was another question here. Let me pull it up. It's about a man whose daughter was a passenger on a motorcycle and was killed in an accident. Now, he didn't sue, and he accepted the insurance policy relieving him of responsibility. He thought the court would serve a proper remedy because there were two victims. The sentence for the driver was a 10-year sentence suspended upon 5 years of probation. This is not a remedy. There was a life lost for reckless driving. Do I file an appeal or a writ of error, or do you have some other advice?
Yeah, that's a difficult case. You know, I'd have to get a little deeper to see what was going on to give any thoughts on that. But it's a hard thing to look at. You know, you have to ask yourself, as far as the desire of having this individual being in jail and being more jail time, which is what I'm getting at of this, right? That they think that the 5 years was not enough or something. Is that part
there
of
is no jail time, John. It was probation.
Just probation.
5 years
okay.
Probation, yeah.
Okay, well, look, you know, you got to be careful because you're personally injured by this, that you're not looking for revenge, I mean, on the one hand. And maybe it was, again, I don't know anything about it, so I really can't say right or wrong on any of these things. But, you know, was it an accident? Was it really an accident? You know, were they drunk or something? I mean, if they were drunk, then absolutely they were, you know... They should be in deep, deep doo-doo. But the most important thing here is not so much punishment by jail, but restitution, okay? You know, that's really what should be looked at, and that's what the jury should be looking at. But the courts are not structured that way. They're structured on how the government could make money out of this. That's all they're interested in. The whole court system is set up because clearly any of the victims, the people who have been assaulted and beat up or even murdered, there's no justice for them. There's no restitution for them. There's nothing for them. Oh, you can go have yourself a civil case if you want, you know, and see what you can get at. We got what we want. No. There should not be two cases. There's one case. And the jury's eye should be on restitution at all times. And restitution doesn't necessarily mean going to jail. You know, a person can suffer for quite some time and be paying that suffering just in the fact through restitution, okay? So that's what really has to be visited there. Whether that case could be reopened up and looked at is a whole different story. You know, was there a jury involved? But, of course, all juries are stacked. I haven't met one that wasn't yet. Sometimes the stacked juries go astray and they become runaway juries. Thank God. But anyway, So that's a way you can break open that case. Because the jury found guilty of something and then the judge put the decisions on what was going to take place, well, there's a question there. You know, what does that make? How is it that jury has any power or authority to be the final word on that, number one, on that? And how do they have the power or authority to be the final word on the fact that that they're a stacked jury? So all of those put together, I think you could probably build a case, open everything up, and go back to square one. That's my opinion. Uphill battle. Every lawyer in the world will be against you. They will be scratching their head. I don't understand. You know, I see that all the time because they go into, I don't know what happens to these people. You know, maybe there's an electrical short in their brain or something. I just don't know. We write papers that the common person reads and they get it. They see the name of Thomas Jefferson making a quote or one of our other founding fathers, or we quote the United States Supreme Court, and they get it. They get it. But these lawyers, I don't know what is up with these people. They have this short. They just can't get that point. I don't understand. You know, they've learned so much in their schools of statutes and all these different rules and regulations and the way the process goes and all these things, okay, because government is trying to make the decision of every court case that's out there, and for every action that takes place, they got to have a formula of some kind, so they think. That's why all these statutes are there, by the way. And that's all they know. And when you come talk about the real law, they just can't get it. Because once, you know what it is, you know, I met an individual once, and they wrote a book, the foundation of their book, Total Error. And they were really, and I said, you know, I told the person, you got a major foundational flaw in this book, and you know, and this person kind of saw it, but didn't go back to correct it. Why? Too much invested. Too much of an investment, you see? That's the problem. Now, these lawyers have such an investment in their education, in their thinking, in their foundation. If they have to read what Thomas Jefferson had to say, they had to read the Kentucky Resolution, or they had to read the Anti-Federalist Papers and some of the positions on that, and they had to read the Constitution. Oh, my goodness, we'll have a heart attack if they read the Constitution, you know. They have to read the Constitution, okay? They go into cardiac arrest because it is so opposite of everything they learned. So they get this wall they built up, and they're just, they prefer the ignorance. They prefer what they got because I'm making money here. I'm doing my thing. I got power. I got prestige. I got authority. I have respect. Hey, I don't want to go that way. You know, that the question is, you know, I'm willing to rip the whole, everything I know, I'm ready in a heartbeat to rip anything out of my thinking in any way, shape, or form if I'm in error. And anybody that's been following along with National Liberty Alliance for a while, they've seen our corrections as we go along. We never stop correcting ourselves. It's part of the learning educational process, finding that correction. Because, mark my words, guaranteed, every individual, no matter how smart you think you are, you have an error somewhere. You just don't know it yet. And be careful to pay attention to other people that might shine the light on that error and make that point where you can become corrected. Some people may do it in a not-so-nice way. Some people may be trying to correct you, and really they're wrong. You know, that happens a lot, I see. And they refuse the correction. But, you know, you just move on. But, you know, correction is grievous to those who have forsaken the way. That's what the Bible tells us. So there it is. It's grievous to them. They don't want to hear it. So it's going to be an uphill battle for that court case, a really, really struggle. Could it be won? Yeah, but you got to do some real good paper writing. You got to get some memorandum. You got to really come in there. You can't let one dot or one tittle pass by that hasn't been approached. You have to think about what their strategy is going to be when you bring this in. And you can come with a lot of good ideas on what that's going to be. And you can structure your paperwork in such a way and fortify it with all the necessary memorandums of facts and truths and law to give that foundation to that action, that law paper that you write. And it could be pristine. And that's what you're going to need to win that kind of a case. And so if you're not educated enough to be able to do that yet, you need to dig in and follow some of the things we talked about tonight. Follow this education. Get the best education in the world. The best education any individual can have is an education of a self-education. I don't care what anyone says. I'm self-educated in everything I've ever done. I dropped out of school. I never made it past the ninth grade. Okay, I dropped out in the ninth grade, but I never even graduated the ninth grade. But I did get a GED later on. I did go a couple of years of college, bored to tears. I had to leave there. But my education continued. I just took it to books and then eventually the computer. And the computer is unbelievable. You know, I mean, wow, what an education you can get on a computer. What an education you can get at National Liberty Alliance. We, I believe, are second to none. I challenge anyone to disprove that, to argue that point. We are second to none on solutions in both the political and the judicial realms and the educational necessities and needs for our children. We are second to none on any of those issues, and we bring it all together. We are second to none on building and creating for the grassroots to take back control of their local government through the committees of safety. We are second to none. I challenge anyone. Think about this for a week or two. Come back in 2 weeks. Bring your ammunition. Debate it. And we will win that argument. We will show you National Liberty Alliance is doing the best job available. Not perfect. We have errors. We know. We just don't know where they're at yet. But we'll find them. We're looking for them. All right. Are we done?
Yes, that's all I had.
Okay, Gerard, are you here yet?
Yes,
I see
here.
Gerard is here. Yep. I'm going to pass the controls over to you in a minute. First, I'm going to introduce Brent. Brent, I see, is here. So we're going to introduce Brent. Brent Winters is the author of The Excellence of the Common Law. His website is commonlawyer.com, and he comes with us every week to teach us something, and he's talking about the Declaration of Independence coming up now. Brent, you got the mic. Before you take the mic, Gerard, you got the controls? I heard a Your mic is muted if you're trying to... there you go.
Yeah, I got
it. Okay, flap them lips. Let me know you're here and alive. Come on. All right, he's got it. Brent, you got the mic. Thank you.
Hey, John, I'm here. And my opinions may or may not be the opinions of National Liberty Alliance, but I'm here by invitation. I enjoyed being here by invitation. Matter of fact, I am appreciative of it. It's an opportunity for me to unload so I won't swell up and burst. But it is important what we say, or I wouldn't be saying it. And the only remedy for the lawlessness we see swirling about us is true law. There is no other remedy. There never has been. There never will be. And true law is from the true lawgiver. James the Apostle says there is only one true lawgiver. It's obvious who that is, the maker of heaven and earth and all that in them is. And William Blackstone tells us. And our Declaration of 76, that's what we're talking about here, points it out in no uncertain terms that there are two volumes of our fundamental law, two. These and no others, these and no more, and those two volumes, our Declaration of 76 says, are the laws of nature, and that is the laws of nature unwritten in the nature of things. But obvious to our eyes, to anyone who wants to, as John Locke says, feel a little, he can find them. The laws of nature, Volume 1, Volume 2, the laws of nature's God, says William Blackstone, written in the Bible. These two volumes are the sum total of the closed canon of the God's revelation of his will to man. How do I know? Because the final rule of faith and practice is on paper. It's written down. And the writer to the Hebrews says that it's closed. And we are to take what we have and we are to apply it. And it applies. Its applicability is myriad as creative and as myriad as the experiences of mankind. And that's saying a lot. There's a lot of things I haven't experienced and a lot of things I never will experience. And no matter how hard a man tries, he doesn't know everything. There are always new people, new innovations, taking the laws of nature, putting them together for the benefit of mankind and sometimes to the abuse and detriment of mankind. And when we do, we call those inventions, by the way, invention. That's taking the laws of nature, combining them in such a way that men can be a benefit or be a burden to others for evil purposes. In all of those cases, the law never changes. It still applies just as it always did to the days of the internet and electronic signatures on contracts, which we have now. The courts have taken the principles of commitment, of acts of commitment, of acts of promise, acts of undertaking, revealed and shown by electronic signatures. That's just one example. The fundamental principle, says our Supreme Court, in the old McPherson case. I have a friend named McPherson, and he says, I hear him say to people often, there is no fear in McPherson. It's McPherson. The old McPherson case back from the 1920s, McPherson versus Buick Motor Company, says that the principle never changes. That's right. The law never changes. That's why we call it law, because it never changes. We're in the Declaration of 76, paragraph 20. The colonists are making their common law complaint, and they say, paragraph 20, that they're complaining because King George, by the sovereignty among men on earth, on land, limited sovereignty, a contradiction of terms, by the way, but we don't know how else to say it, so that's what we say, limited sovereignty among men, were upset at George III for depriving us, that's us, the Americans, in many cases of the benefits of trial by jury. That's one of the reasons why we went to war. You see, the jury, of course, the jury is only known in common law countries. And the colonists here in the New World saw that King George III and his cronies, his fellow beneficiaries of the Bank of London, and its trading arm, the British East India Company, the colonists saw that what they were doing in order to gain power over them for purposes of profit through the Bank of London, through its trading arm, they saw that they were trying to deprive them. That's a nice word. Instead of saying take away, Tom Jefferson puts the word in here, depriving us in many cases. Not in all cases, it says, in many cases, of the benefits of trial by jury, which the First Congress said is an inestimable right. Why did they say that? Well, because they knew it. They understood it. It was precious to them, and it ought to be precious to us. God gave it to us, trial by jury. They don't have it in France, Germany, South America, Russia, China. They don't have it anywhere in the world. But in the English-speaking world, the five common law countries and the countries that are protected under them. I think I'd said this last time. I'll say it again. Rhode Island, back in those days, loathed, to use a word Bill Clinton made famous, he said he loathed military service. He loathed military people. Well, Rhode Island loathed the law of the city, the civil law. And this loathing was so strong that she conducted her vice admiralty court. That's a civil law kind of a tribunal, a martial kind of a jurisdiction. But Rhode Island used the jury, because they weren't going to allow the king and his cronies, parliamentarians, all many of them beneficiaries of the Bank of London and the trading arm, the British East India Company. They were trying to take away trial by jury. Once trial by jury is taken away, once there is no trial by jury, then the government can conduct trial by government instead of trial by jury. Jurors are not the government. One of the great ruses of our own day is the blurring of the distinction between the government and the private people. And once that distinction is blurred, then the government will run over the people. It's all a matter of form. I know But it really works that way. People say, well, but we are the government. Well, that's not a practical thing to say. I know that we're the ones in charge as a matter of lawful theory. But when the bureaucrats say that we're going to partner with them and they want to partner with us, just keep in mind they have a monopoly on force and violence. There won't be any partnership to it. They'll take you in, take the private sector in, and abuse the private sector. They're doing it now. Don't look. They're doing it now. And it's getting worse by a exponential degree as we move along. Well, because they had the jury in the Admiralty Courts in Rhode Island, conviction of bureaucrats became very rare. I'd mentioned this last time. Massachusetts, I'll say it again one more time. This is amazing. Flabbergasting it is. Massachusetts hated civil canon law so much, coming from its Puritan roots, the reason the Puritans came here. Hated it so much that she refused to establish any equity courts in Massachusetts until the year 1873. That's over 200 years Massachusetts didn't recognize equity jurisdiction. Well, what George did, Britain, the sovereignty of George, he was responsible, although he really didn't do it directly. But the British extended civil laws, admiralty jurisdiction among the colonists from off the ships onto the piers, into the warehouses, and thence down the streets and into the homes, saying they had a right to do that because into the homes, contraband was coming in by ship and taxes weren't being paid on it. And the idea, once they extended the law of the city, the admiralty law, into the home, they said conviction or trial for crimes didn't rate a jury because that was admiralty jurisdiction. And also, under admiralty jurisdiction, there is no right against unlawful searches and seizures without a warrant, that is. Listen, if you're on a ship and the master-at-arms wants to bust into your locker to see if you got cocaine inside, or bust into your locker for any other reason, he doesn't need a warrant. He just needs a suspicion. He just needs to say, I want to look. That is the law of the sea on every ship that steams under the flag of the United States, all the merchant ships, all the naval ships. And so if that jurisdiction is extended from ships onto land, there is no Fourth Amendment right against unwarranted searches and seizures. Well, that's what was happening. And by denying these rights, Britain, the government of Britain, lowered enforcement costs of tax collection, you see. It cost money to take time to have people to draw up affidavits, go present them before a neutral and detached magistrate, and then wait for a decision. Well, all of this, let's get rid of all this red tape and just bust down people's doors and go in and see if they have some contraband. If they do, we'll arrest them and we'll try them without the jury, and that'll teach these colonists not to break the law. You see, Britain was using the law, they said. They were using what they considered, what they said was legitimate law, to dominate and terrorize. Sound familiar? FISA courts and all that unconstitutional baloney. And no matter how thin you slice it, and they'll slice it pretty thin and explain it, but no matter how thin you slice it, it remains, as we've always said, baloney remains baloney. That's what it is. No jurisdiction to do such things. Let's see. King George set up boards of bureaucrats with unconstitutional powers to extend the jurisdiction of admiralty courts. See, he got to slice it real thin, getting detailed about it, saying it was all legal. But he did this not only for collecting taxes, but also for the trial of all cases arising within the colony. Let me repeat that. He set up boards of bureaucrats with unconstitutional powers. Unconstitutional? You say, well, England doesn't have a constitution. Oh, yes, she does, still today. And still calls it her constitution. What is it? It's our common law. And we called it our Constitution, too. And when the Declaration of 76 was written, it was written to complain that England was violating the constitutional rights of colonists. And so when our Constitution was written, put in written form, it is a brief of common law government, so it was natural we called it our Constitution, because it is no different in fundamentals, and there's nothing in it but fundamentals. There's no difference between what's there and what the Anglo-Saxon and Celtic settlers in Britain did with their government before the Norman invasion. The whole idea was to return us to, and William Blackstone makes a big point of this, Anglo-Saxon government. Before the year 1066, that was the purpose, by the way, of Magna Carta also, drafted in the year 1215, was to return England to Anglo-Saxon government before 1066. Well, that I just quoted there was from the first journal of Continental Congress, 1774-1789, pages 63 through 73. I said first journal. I should have said it this way. Volume 1 of the Journal of the Continental Congress, that about George setting up these bureaucrats to try all cases. In our day, it would be as though IRS agents, IRS is an administrative civil law arm of the executive branch of government of the President of the United States. It would be as if IRS agents set as judges without any jury over all felony, all misdemeanor, all tort, and all contract cases. That is what England did to the colonists here in America. They put bureaucrats in charge of the courts and didn't allow the jury. Well, now, wait a minute. Maybe that is what the IRS is doing today. They set up their own court from the agency called the tax court. It's not a judicial court. It's an administrative court. It's not in the judicial branch of government. It's in the executive branch of government. It's the president's court. That's not a court at all. It makes me wonder why they wear black robes. I guess that's to fool people, fool the public. Well, then, who administers health care at the national level? By the way, wholly unconstitutional. Where, pray tell, in the Constitution of the United States is authority granted to the federal government to have any jurisdiction over matters of health, education, and welfare? Answer, it's not like it takes a legal scholar. Any third-grade kid could read it and tell you this. It's not in there. And if the powers aren't granted, the Constitution does not delegate them to the federal government, then there is no power to the federal government. And it has been the policy and the constitutional understanding of our country from the very beginning that health, education, and welfare are the purview and the jurisdiction of the states individually for themselves. The federal government has no jurisdiction to act respecting education, health, or general welfare. Or, no, welfare specific. I got that backwards. You can't avoid general welfare. Whatever the government does is supposed to be good for folk. But specific welfare? No. That's why our Constitution says general welfare. You can't discriminate between one state and another. Whatever the federal government does better be clean across the board, equal protection of the law for everybody. The states don't have to worry about that. The states just have to worry about being fair with their own citizens, their own residents, not residences. But IRS now extends its power to enforce and judge matters concerning the new health care bill. Our Declaration of 76 teaches above all things that the powers that be are creative without end in devising schemes to deny trial by jury. Let me say that again. I get impatient with myself. I'll say it slower. Our Declaration teaches above all things that the powers that be are creative without end in devising schemes to deny trial by jury. Why? Because the jury threatens those ever-present government dependents out to abuse their power through terror, domination, jailing, and plundering. What are the tools of government? I'll tell them to you again. Here's four of them. Terror, domination, jailing, and plundering. Those are the tools of government. George Washington put it even more tersely than that. He says government is force. That's it. He did say it's not eloquence, it's not persuasion, it is force. And he would have known it as good as anybody, because more than anybody of his day, he employed the force, the power, the monopoly of violence of government against not only a foreign enemy, but he employed it also against folks that were making whiskey in the Whiskey Rebellion and didn't want to pay the tax that the government was putting on them, so it was unfair. Probably was, by the way. And it's questionable what George Washington did in that case. He used United States troops to put down a rebellion, standing army. But he understood force. I'll say that for him. He had been a soldier since he was 19 years old, thereabouts. He rose in rank. The reason he got so mad at the... I'll drop a footnote here. It's an important footnote. The reason he was willing to do what he did against the British, among many other things, he was a principled man, yes, and he saw the abuses that occurred. But he wouldn't have been so fiery about it, and he wouldn't have been so convicted about it if the British officer corps had not snubbed him when he was a young man. He wanted more than anything else to be a British officer, an army officer. And it hurt him deeply, it cut him deeply, that the British officer corps of the army slighted him continually. Because he was a colonial. He was ticked. And when he got his, you go read about it, when he got his opportunity to strike a blow back and teach them a lesson, and he thought he had principle of law behind it, he willingly accepted, and he prosecuted it as far as he could. You going to make fun of me? I'm just a goofy colonial? I'm a rustic? So he employed force and threat of force and domination. That's what war is. Dominating the other fellow by force, threat of force, terror. What do you think men used to wear those big tall hats and those bright red uniforms and shine their brass so it would flash and gleam in the sun as they marched across the battlefield? The idea was to strike terror into the enemy. That's what it was. Is there a place for that? Yes, there is. But it is not outside of the military context, not outside of armies on fields of battle and ships on the high seas, admiralty law, martial law of the city, bureaucratic law. One more section. The colonists were mad because the Brits, the Crown, was transporting us, paragraph 21, transporting us beyond seas to be tried for pretended offenses. Our common law tradition is against wholesale manufacturing of crimes by legislative decree. In short, if the behavior in question seriously injured no one else, it is no crime. That's our common law. According to our common law, the jury best recognizes crimes in hindsight. Not some legislator trying to control future behavior, speculating through administrative code decrees and other legislation in foresight. Don't miss this. Our common law fundamentally is diametrically opposed, diametrically, big word. It means exact opposite. Diametrically opposed to the law of the city. Our common law is the law of the land. That's another name for it, and our Constitution uses that name, Article 6. But one of the most fundamental distinctions between our common law, we are a common law country at every point, our very culture is common law. Even our measuring system is common law. It's about fairness. It's about practicality. It's about facts, not scholasticism, not reasoning. But another way it's different is that the law of the city is based upon a code, legislation, if you will, decrees, pronouncements of government, commands. That's what pronouncements of government are. That is what legislation is. It is a command, watch this, about the future. It is an attempt of men to control the future, to preempt the future behavior of men. That, friends, neighbors, and kin, is not freedom. What does our common law do by distinction? Our common law, by grand distinction, doesn't bound itself on legislation, although legislation occurs, yes. There's no problem until there's a problem, common law. People go to court, and then we ask the jury, we don't ask them about the future, we ask them about what happened in the past. Who done it? Why did he do it? How did he do it? Where did he do it? Give us the facts, Mr. Juror. And once we got the facts, the conclusion is foregone. But we ask the jury to establish the facts of the past. The legislature, we expect to speak to the future. Can the common law tradition exist with legislation? Yes, it can. Matter of fact, it has to. Is legislation important? Yes, in the right context, it's important. And it is part of our common law tradition, but in a very limited sense. And what is the limit of legislation? Well, most fundamentally, the limit of legislation is the judicial branch. The judicial branch gets to interpret the legislation in its application. That's power. There's real power in deciding right from wrong in individual instances. That's where the real power is, and that's the definition anciently of lawgiver. What is a lawgiver? Well, we in the Anglo-Saxon tongue, or English, we call such a person a god, or such a combination of persons, like a jury. We call them gods, with little g, not big G. And the Bible does the very same thing and calls the judges and the jurors of Israel and the Psalms gods, little g. Because in the limited sense, here on land, among men, not ultimately, but among men, we must decide. And those who decide right from wrong in individual instances, from whose decision there is no meaningful appeal. As far back as the ancient recorded history of man goes, were called gods. In the Hebrew Old Testament, they were called Elohims. Elohim, that's plural, or El. We translate that God. It means lawgiver. In the New Testament, Theos, we translate that God. We translate it into the English God, but fundamentally it means lawgiver, the final arbiter of right and wrong from whose decision there is no meaningful appeal. Well, according to our common law, as we'd said, the jury recognizes and establishes the past. What happened? The law of the city, by contrast to the law of the land, demands that one's private conscience yield to the state's will. The state's will, as commanded by its codes, by its legislation, by its decrees. Listen to Herman Melville. Herman Melville wrote Moby Dick, but Herman Melville wrote many other seafaring stories, and his father-in-law, by the way, he was American, but his father-in-law was a fellow by the name of Shea. He was Chief Justice of the Supreme Court of the state of Massachusetts. And Justice Shea was a positivist. What does that mean? He's one of those fellows, and I don't criticize Justice Scalia very often, but he's just mortal, and I'll criticize him here. Scalia was like Justice Shea. If it was written on paper, that ended the matter. If some law was written on paper, that ended the matter, a piece of legislation. You follow it, you parse it, you follow it to a T. That's what Justice Scalia said. Well, that's not our common law tradition. Our common law tradition says that the courts have an unhampered, unfettered power over application of legislation. Why? Because legislators, although they are gods with a little g in their own way, I suppose they think they are, they're not. They're mortals. And judges are mortals too, by the way. That's why the only power they have is the power to make those decisions. They don't have the power to enforce them. Not really. This common law tradition is a wonderful tradition, and our government is in the common law tradition. The balance of power between it's a continual. never-ending Mexican three-way standoff between the three branches of government. But Melville said this. Melville made one of his characters say this, a Captain Beery, a naval captain. And this fellow said, private conscience must yield to that conscience imperially formulated by the code. Let me repeat that. Private conscience, said Captain Beery, must yield to that conscience imperially formulated in the code. What code? Well, in this case, he was talking about the Admiralty Code, because Captain Beery was the captain of a man of war, a warship. And the man was hung and executed for a crime he did not intend. But Beery said, well, if the code says it, it doesn't make any difference what your intent is. Well, that's not our common law. Now, that's military law. That's justifiable in a military context. Within limits, there are always limits, but not at common law. So, in the law of the city, in short, the end, that is the government's will, justifies the means. And what are the means? You must obey the state's command. But don't miss this. The end justifies the means. So due process doesn't really matter, you see. But in our law of the land tradition, our common law, the means, the process, justifies the end. See, there's another fundamental distinction. And the distinctions are not that the two traditions do not see eye to eye. The distinctions are the two traditions are standing back to back, looking in opposite directions. They're opposite at every fundamental point. Hence, the civil law says obedience to government is full defense to a crime. You obeyed the government, doesn't make any difference what you did. Doesn't make any difference how many people you murdered, who you plundered. I mean, is it any surprise that Jesus Christ said to the civil law scholastics of his day, called the Pharisees, or as some people say, the Pharisites, the Sadducees, the Jews, of leaders of Babylonian Judaism, he said to them, Jesus Christ said, you fellows make void the law of God by your regulations. That's what regulations do when they're applied. Regulations. And they are behind regulations. That is bureaucratic law, administrative law, law passed without any due process. Just the decrees of bureaucrats and executives until before World War II, our courts consistently said that's not law. But now, the courts say the presumption is it is law, and you've got to overcome that presumption. That's how much we've changed. We still retain our common law. Let's talk about it. Let's think like Americans. What is it that distinguishes us from the rest of the world? It isn't that we got cowboys. That held us up for a while as a distinction. Everything from Buffalo Bill to Roy Rogers and John Wayne and Clint Eastwood. But that fizzles out after a while. And before cowboys came along, we had a distinction. What was it? Our common law. That's what it was. And it still is. We are unique. We are more English in our common law than the English themselves. We have truly tried to hark back to pre-1066, as Justice James Wilson of the United States Supreme Court observed. He said, we're more like, our law is not like that of England today. Our law is like that of the Anglo-Saxons before the Norman invasion. Well, I've beat that up for one day. I won't say it again, but the civil law and the civil law, the law of the city, obedience to government is a full defense to any crime. And this principle, that obedience to government is a full defense to any crime, has fostered the atrocities of ancient Babylon, of ancient Egypt, of ancient Rome, of modern-day Nazism, communism, and presently Islam. Islam is fundamentally the law of the city, as is Judaism and Romanism. Well, King George's prosecutors were accusing Americans of crimes, but instead of respecting their right to be tried before the common law jury of their peers, that's redundant, there's only one kind of jury, that's the common law jury. But instead of allowing them to be tried before their neighbors, that's what a peer is, your neighbor, he's nigh unto you, each in his own colony and county, King George III removed them to civil laws, admiralty tribunals in England. To commit a crime in America, if they could attach our admiralty jurisdiction, you were shackled, put aboard a ship, and hauled away to England to be tried. That's where the admiralty court was, you see. That way, you didn't have a chance to a jury. Even if they had paddled one, it wouldn't be your neighbors. And everybody in England in those days that mounted anything didn't. They scorned colonists. In justification, Parliament has resurrected a forgotten statute that Henry VIII had signed over 200 years before this. Well, bottom line, our Constitution of the United States follows the common law tradition. Of course, it's a common law document. It says there that if you're tried for a crime under the in the federal courts, that the jury is to be impaneled from the jurisdiction, from the boundaries, having been preset before the trial or the accusation of the crime ever occurred, from that district, pre-established. Why? Well, that reduces an opportunity for stacking jurors in another place, you see, and controlling, which happens anyway. It's bad enough the way it is. Why make it worse and have somebody allow them to be shipped off to another area? You know, it's popular among prisoners, and America imprisons more people than any country per capita on the face of God's green earth. It's popular among those folks when they see each other. When a new guy comes into the county jail, when a new guy comes into the prison, first thing they say to him is, "Where'd you catch your case? Where'd you catch your case?" That's the slang. That means, where did you receive the accusation? Because where you receive the accusation is where you're going to be tried. Well, that's what our Constitution requires. And that's what they're complaining about here when they say that you're transporting us beyond seas to be tried for not even offenses, but pretended offenses. Well, thanks again. Thanks again to the National Liberty Alliance for letting me say a few words. And Gerard, if I didn't put you to sleep, back to you. Sounds like I may have put him to sleep, either that or I'm talking to myself and the ones listening. I can never know when I'm on the telephone. But I think I heard something on the other end.
I can hear you.
Oh, thank you.
We'll have to wake up Gerard here. Let's see if we can stir him.
Gerard's a working man. He works all day, every day. So we're glad to have him on the call. But if you want me to keep talking, I will. But if you want to wait for Gerard to...
I'm here. I just went to fill my water up.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, Gerard. Good to see you. Or good to hear you, rather.
One and the same. Okay. You hear me, then you see me. Anyway, I'm going to start with the question and answer. If anybody's got a question for myself or Brent or John, for that matter, we'll hark them in. So with that, let me open up the first victim, who happens to be Crystal from Connecticut. Go ahead, Crystal. Oh, Crystal, I know she's been trying to get through for 2 weeks. Come on, speak now or forever hold your peace. I hate to recycle her back, but we probably put her to sleep. Oh, well. Going once, going twice. Let's see who comes up after this. Well, Crystal, get back in the queue and I'll try to bring you in. Okay, Alyssa from Connecticut, you've been unmuted.
Okay, can you hear me?
I can.
Okay. I had a question, which I'm trying to look for a little bit of help. I currently live in a co-op that folded, and it was a merger that took place. The co-op had a 99-year lease, and another company is coming in. They're in the process of, they didn't buy me out. They bought out other units, but they didn't buy me out. But they're in the process of taking me to housing court to have me evicted.
It's a co-op, and it's a, and what else is it?
It's a co-op that folded, and they now, their rental unit, they changed it to rental unit.
Oh, I see. So, well, I don't know what to tell you about that. It could be very complicated. First of all, the original contract that you had, they should have had some kind of clause in there if the thing were to fold, because you've signed an agreement and somebody has to uphold that agreement. Now, did they have a clause in there that says they could turn them into apartments? You must have put money down. You must have had money invested into owning it as a co-op or owning a piece of it. You know, right. I mean, it's a pretty straightforward contract law case. I mean, there should be no shenanigans there. You know, I don't know what they think their ability is to change them into apartments, unless that was part of the agreement that you originally signed. Without looking at that kind of paperwork, I don't think I could answer any kind of question like that tonight on this call.
Okay.
You know,
okay.
I don't know. Without seeing the paperwork, or you know, and knowing what they did to begin with, because look at they're still, you have an agreement with them and they're bound by it. Now I don't know. You know, one thing I learned in real estate is they used to tell you when you put up money, earnest money, and you want to make sure you get it back, make sure you put weasel clauses in it, they call them. Yeah. And like subject to the approval of my associates and things like that. So you see, that contract you signed could have had certain what's known as, you know, certain things that activate, they, you know, short term, you know, in slang, they're known as weasel clauses, and that might be what they're operating on. I don't know, but I mean, that gets very, when you have co-ops and things like that and condominiums, you know, it can get pretty convoluted in a contract. So I don't know what your contract, you know, what it covered. So, but it should be, I think it should be pretty cut and dried, as long as, you know, everybody's holding to, you know, what was signed and what was there originally. So I don't know what they're operating under or what, you know, what they think they can do or they can't do. That's a tough one.
Well, they feel like that they now own majority of the units, like 90% of the units, and therefore, like, I have to leave and I don't have the option of staying.
Well, it seems to me they would have to compensate you for the portion that you put up of the portion of your ownership. I don't know. See, without seeing the contract that you signed originally, I mean, who cares? They own 90%. Guess what? If there's only 10% out there, it would seem to me they'd still have to honor that, unless there's something, some kind of clause that says that they can force you out that way. And it seems to me that would not be a contract if you weren't compensated. By the very name of a contract means that we came to a meeting of the minds, an agreement. You can't have a one-sided contract, because then it's not a contract. It's a pact or a death, you know, what they call mortgages, a death pact, till death separates you, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know what they're doing today. There's all kinds of craziness out there, though. And most of the time, they don't hold to the law. They make it up as they go. So I really don't know what agreement you signed with them or why they believe that, you know, at this point, they could treat you like a tenant. I know, like in tax cases, if you don't pay your taxes in New York State, they use an in rem procedure, and they take your land, or they take your title away, and you don't own it. And when they kick you off, They send the same form to the sheriff as a landlord would send to a tenant. So you become no more than a scofflaw tenant on your own land at the point that they do their in rem procedure for taking your property away. And they're pretty egregious here, because they steal all your equity with it. Used to be like if you owed a couple thousand in taxes and they had to take your property to get it, and they sold the house, and they sold it for $90,000, and you only owe $2,000. The difference would go back to the homeowner. That doesn't happen anymore, because what they do is they convert the deed before they do the transfer and the sale, and so they steal the house from you, and they say they own it. And basically, what they're doing is they're stealing your equity. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. You know, the fact that they think they can justify that is pretty strange in my mind, you know. But,
right.
And then you're here, you know, telling me that they got 90% and they're going to kick you out and you have no choice. Sounds like more of the same in rem baloney, but I don't know for sure without seeing documentation, you know what I mean?
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you very much. Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. I don't know. We have a 513 number. We have no name. You've been unmuted. Can you hear?
Hello?
Yes. Who's this?
Oh, hi. My name is Kelly. I'm from Cincinnati, Ohio. I'm calling on behalf of my family, the Camisi family.
Okay.
And they were dealing with different cases of, adverse possession. They told me to call in because they are now incarcerated. I don't know if you guys are familiar with their situation.
Yeah, I think John was discussing this with somebody last week, where the son was in jail, but the rest of the family was out.
Yes, that's correct. Well, the marshals ended up coming and picking the rest of them up, and now everyone is in jail. And this is really based off of, first possession. And the questions that they wanted me to ask, because they're all locked up, is how, because they put it in federal. I guess whoever they talked to also spoke on and saying, like, you know, they should put it in federal or whatever.
Right.
So they want to know how to take it from state to federal.
Well, they have to move it into federal for cause. And I know John went into a very lengthy explanation of that last week. I mean, if you look at, we do have paperwork where we've moved our cases into the federal court for cause. And, you know, the tricky thing with, it's not tricky, but you have to know how to fight and file cases in a federal issue. But you see, in the federal, you're going to fight against your due process rights that they're violating. You're not necessarily talking about the ifs, ands, or buts of the case. What you have to have is you have to have the things that they did where they violated your due process, which they do all along the way anyway. So,
okay, I believe they did that. I'm sorry, I believe they did that. They filed a 42.
I'm sorry, what? They did what?
I said, I believe they did that. I believe they filed a 42 explaining, you know, how.
Oh, U.S. 42? Yep. So it's in the it's in the federal court then right now, right? Or no?
Well, yeah, it is in the federal court, but the same judge that's, giving them the arraignments or whatever, setting up the arraignments, he's still over the case. It's still in state. Like my mother, and it's my mom, she had court today. They gave her a $2 million bond for this. They don't even have any properties or titles or anything, but they don't want it in that. I mean, for him to give a $2 million bond, they don't have any previous, even from juvenile records to now adult records, they don't have any previous records. For them to give a $2 million bond, we are definitely trying to get it out of the state. And but we did send the 42. They did accept it because I'm the one that's down doing everything. They did accept it. The marshals sent the paperwork or whatever that the marshals needed to send to the judge and everyone. We just don't understand why is he still over everything.
Well, if it was a state judge and you're in federal court, you shouldn't have the same judge. That sounds pretty fugazi to me. I don't know what they're telling you. I mean, if you filed in a federal court, did they charge you a fee for bringing in a federal court or no? Or did you waive that?
No. I think we waived it. I forgot what it's called, the indigency.
Well, you shouldn't have to pay anyway because they brought you in there by violating your rights, but they always want to charge you. Or what did they say? You were indigent, so they would let you go in without paying?
I'm not sure. I mean, I when I filed the paperwork, I didn't give any money. So I filed everything, and so I didn't give any money. I'm not sure. But
well, they should have assigned a judge. They should have assigned a judge to it. And then you should go to that judge And you should tell them you need an injunction against the lower court so they can cease and desist until the case is decided.
So we need an injunction?
He needs to make an injunction against the lower court to cease and desist until the case is heard. You know, they're gonna keep steamrolling over you. I don't remember what the incidence was of why they were taking the property or how they took the property to begin with. What was the story with that?
Now that part I'm not really sure because I'm just now learning all of this. I mean, it's my mother, my sister, my two brothers, my brother's fiance. Well,
this was a house that they owned?
No, I don't think it was a house that they owned, but I'm not really sure. I know it was a property they were interested in, and they went to court to, you know, file paperwork on these properties, but I'm not really sure what steps and what route they took. But their question, and another question of hers is, well, I guess you kind of answered that too, like, is it a conflict of interest for the judge to still be on the case in state when he's the one?
I don't know how you can file a federal case and the state judge is still well, I know the state court can still move ahead if you don't stop them in the federal court. You need to look at that federal case and make sure that it's filed and make sure that they assign the judge to it. And then you need to have a hearing with that judge, and you have to say, look, Your Honor, they're steamrolling over us. We have a due process issue here, and I would like you to put an injunction on them until this case is decided. It's not a big deal. You know what I mean? It sounds to me like, you know, this judge is involved somehow. He wants to put a $2 million bond on somebody that he doesn't even know or has no excuse. Sounds like you got some corruption going on there, but you need to find out who the federal judge is, and you need to make have a hearing with him and put in for an injunction against the lower court, because that's what you're doing.
Okay.
They should not be able to proceed against you while you have a case, and you should put that judge in the case too. You should sue him in the federal court.
Yeah, we're suing him in the federal court, so that's why we don't understand how
he needs to. Then he needs to recuse himself. He can't keep going.
Well, he keeps going, and we don't know how to stop him. And so that's the question that my mother had me at. Well, she wanted to know, like, how can we change the venue? How can we get out of state?
Well, if you are in fact in the federal court, you need to talk to that federal judge. Anything he does, I would give him a writ of error. Copy our writ of errors that we have online. And give him a writ of error, you know what I mean, and remove him yourself from the case. You remove him, and make the case in the other court for an injunction, and tell the judge that you're suing that judge for trespassing or whatever on the case, and that he needs to command him to behave. That's what, you know, and they love to do that, by the way.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Because they're jealous of their powers. And the federal judge, they don't have a lot of problems slapping a state judge, because that's kind of like the push and pull that goes on between them. So if you're suing him, if you actually put him as a defendant in the suit,
yes, we did.
He needs to step down. But I don't know what else to tell you. I don't want to get all involved in the case here tonight.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I mean, that's the best I can tell you. You know, sometimes if you go up there, you can get help from they do have a pretty good help desk at the federal court with the clerks, you know, as far as he could tell you the paperwork to file to put in that injunction anyway, in order to get some intervention there. Okay?
Great. I will ask that question. Just one more thing, too. Is it legal? Because I was going to the office, like, the clerk of court will not accept any of my motions or affidavits that I'm sending. They won't accept it. They told me that they redirected me to the judge's chambers, the same judge. And when I went there and I said I wanted to file the paperwork, he said, well, no, they're not going to accept the paperwork that you are wanting to file, because that's when they were looking, you know, they were still at large, my mother and my sister and brother. So they wouldn't accept my paperwork filing. But then when I went the next day and wanted to get the transcript of that conversation, the lady that does the transcript, she called me back and said, Well, the judge has ordered for me to not give you the transcript. You have to go to his chambers to request the transcript. And I'm trying to figure out how do I go around him and not go through his chambers.
Yeah, you have to you have to remove him from the case because he's just, look at, I don't know that he can even say that you can't file paperwork because you're at large. I don't know. But, you know, they have a lot of leeway, those judges. So I'm not going to tell you that he can't say that. But it's, you know, I mean, he doesn't want you filing paperwork in a case. You know, that doesn't make sense. And you can go in as a next friend. You know, they're not going to be so friendly to a next friend as they as the federal court is anyway. I think the federal court is a little bit more lenient with a next friend. They're more familiar with it than the state court. They're going to tell you you're not an attorney. You can't speak for them, blah, 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 blah.
And that's exactly what they did. Well, in fact, the federal sent me back a letter saying, because I filed a writ of habeas and I have power of attorney over all of them, so I filed the paperwork where they said that I wasn't a next friend, and they gave me 14 days to, I guess, object or whatever. So that's what I'm working on.
Yeah, be
and
careful when you're doing the habeas, too, because if you put a habeas corpus in, which you should do, there's like a $5 fee, and if you don't pay it, they won't act on it. So don't forget to pay the $5 fee.
Okay. All right. Thank you so much.
Okay. All right. Good luck. God bless you. You know.
Thank you too.
Yeah.
I'll keep you guys posted and updated.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. Next caller. Looks like Linda from Virginia.
Am I on?
You are.
Okay. I had another question, but something interesting in my search. I was searching on removals to federal court, and I did run across a statement that said that filings in federal court does not stop the state court action, except that they cannot file like a final decision on it or something like that. I can't remember the words exactly.
Yeah, they can look at. They can keep moving the case forward depending on what's going on. But
right.
First thing though, if you actually put the judge in the federal case, if you're suing him in federal court, he cannot proceed because that's a conflict of interest right there. If you're making claims that he broke the law and he's violating you, he has to recuse himself. He can't. Now, that case could still go on, but like you said, they can't come to a conclusion because you're making a federal unalienable right case in the federal court, which if you prevail is going to take that whole case and throw it out the window because they violated your unalienable rights. So they can't come. Okay. They're right. They can't come to a decision until the federal case is decided. But that doesn't mean that they can't hold money and make you put money in escrow and all this other garbage that they do to you, you know, while you're in the federal court and you're still defending yourself in the state court. And you can still get an injunction against them for an emergency like taking your home. That's the whole point. You know what I mean? The point may be that they violated your unalienable rights, and that's why they're able to take you out of your house. And that federal judge can put an injunction in stopping them from doing that until the federal case is ruled upon. So, you know, there's rules back and forth between the federal and the state court on how things can and should go. I mean, they like to do what they want to do. And if you don't know any better, they'll just do what they want to do. If you don't object, they'll just do it, you know?
Yeah. It's kind of interesting, though, following this case. It was just the son in jail, and now it's the whole family, and you have to wonder if that wasn't because I know she filed some things, so, you know, I don't know. But.
Well, she did move it into federal court, and they're probably getting a little worried, and somebody sounds to me like, you know, there's a personal vendetta, and somebody wants to break her. Break the case, throw them all in jail so they can't defend themselves. Doesn't sound very good. It sounds like more corruption, you know?
Yeah. Okay, well, my question, you're probably going to say, why does she keep asking the same question? But I'm actually, I invited someone to listen to the podcast tonight, and we were talking. I was telling her about some of the things John had said, and I think she basically needs to go to federal court also.
Well, I'll tell you what. You should have her go into our archives where John made a very lengthy explanation and listen to the reasoning that he gave of you know, how and why you operate there and moving it into federal court and how, you know, it's all on that tape. And so,
do you know where that is and where in the archives?
When you go into, yeah, all these Monday night calls, if you go on the site and you go, go to our Monday night call, that page that comes up, you scroll down and all the recordings are there.
But there's hundreds of them.
They're dated. You go down to the date. You go down to today's date.
Okay.
They used to be on the bottom. You had to scroll through them all, but I think John reversed the order so that the newest is on top. But it doesn't matter because the dates are on them all, and you'll see how they run. They run in chronological order.
Okay, well, I don't want to steal her story or anything, but they basically went after her for hoarding and no due process, same as mine, no due process and all this. And so we get the due process, I think part of it, but she had asked me about what is the, you know, I told her John had said over and over, you always, always, always win on due process and jurisdiction. So I guess she asked me what is jurisdiction, and I had a hard time explaining it to her. My understanding is that, and I'm not sure this is all of it, but that these are constitutional issues, and those state, or what he like, you know, nisi prius courts cannot decide.
Right, they don't have they can't give you remedy because they're the ones breaking that law. So they have no jurisdiction over your charge of a due process claim. They can't rule on themselves and say, and if you challenge jurisdiction, they have to state it. It has to be, you know, proven. And so they can't say because we said so, you know what I mean? Because the question is against them. So they don't have jurisdiction to give you remedy for the charge that you're making, whether they think they do or not. You know, they have a conflict of interest, so obviously they don't have the jurisdiction. And you know, if you're in the federal court bringing up a federal issue, that's what needs to be spoken to, you know?
And is that the extent of the jurisdiction, basically?
Well, look at jurisdiction. You know, sometimes you give them jurisdiction by consenting. So you can give them jurisdiction if you don't know what you're doing. Say the wrong thing in court, and you basically signed into their jurisdiction. That's why you have to be very careful.
I did tell her that. I said, you're not going to argue the facts of the case. If you try to do that, they're going to send it back to state court.
Right, but even in the state court, they may not have jurisdiction over what you're saying. But if you say the wrong thing, you could end up giving them jurisdiction. You know what I mean?
Right.
You know, because I had a case, and I the other side had defaulted, and I went to the clerk and got the default. Then the judge starts the case, and I said, "This case is done, Your Honor, because they defaulted and this and that and everything." And I said, "So the point is moot." And he says, "So what do you want me to do?" And me, stupid me, I said, "Dismiss it." Well, I just gave him jurisdiction.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm.
And so then he didn't dismiss it. He ruled against me. Because I should have said, nothing, there's nothing that you can do. You have no jurisdiction. Right?
Okay.
They're very tricky.
No, I know that.
So you have to be careful. But listen, go back and listen to those tapes because you can listen to them again. And you're going to pull something out every time you listen to it because you'll be able to stop and rewind it and take notes. You know,
I always have that.
When John's telling it to you, it's one thing, but when you listen to it again, you're going to pull more out that you didn't get that night. And I mean, he gave you a very lengthy explanation on that. I wouldn't waste it. I would go back. That's why we tape these calls, because they're a training tool. Okay.
I always have a hard time, like you had brought up the non-judicial foreclosure case.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked for that, and I could not find it. And I don't know. Maybe I just need to send you a message or something. But
well, non-judicial foreclosure, there are states that claim that they're non-judicial, and there are states that claim they're judicial. Now, in New York State, New York State is a judicial state where it has to go through a judge. But they still do non-judicial foreclosures because their tax law is a in rem procedure, which is basically non-judicial, although they have a judge there banging his gavel at some point, I guess, so that they feel like they're satisfying the judicial thing. But meanwhile, they're really violating your due process. It's against the property. It's not against you. They don't even have to talk to you, you know. So
they use the tax law as an inroad to non-judicial.
Yeah, that's the in rem procedure. Basically, makes it into a non-judicial foreclosure. Basically, it's done in rem, and it's done a lot of what they do is done ex parte without you even being there and having a chance to answer. And, you know, even and John makes the claim that there is no such thing as a non-judicial state. That's a violation of your due process right there. The fact that they think that they can, you know, by saying it's non-judicial, that means it can't be judged against. You know, like there's no court there. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're certainly not getting your common law. You know, you're getting a tribunal or what do they call the judges that were like the king there. You know, he's like a king, and what he says goes. There's no jury, nothing, right?
Well, part of the issue is that they say it's set up ahead of time, you know, that way. I mean, so,
right.
I don't know.
And that's why when you open up an Article 3 court, you want to make sure you put all that stuff in there so that you come in and you say, I'm opening a court of record. You're opening it on top of their court. I don't care how they're setting it up ahead of time. Well, you're not agreeing to it. Nisi Prius means unless otherwise, you know, agreed to.
I have a long way to go to understanding Article 3 courts, so...
Well, it's in the Constitution. That's what we're guaranteed. It's in Article 3 of the Constitution, so that's what you're guaranteed. Anything else is an administrative court. It's not under the Constitution. So it's contract law. It's if you agree to it. But, you know, most of these things, you know... may end up violating your unalienable rights, and they need to be an Article 3 court. Especially, look at if it's criminal, or they turn it into criminal, well then you definitely want an Article 3 court, you know, with a jury.
So, but there are no Article 3 courts, right?
No, that's not true. No, they might think they're an Article 3. They may claim to be, but you set it up by making sure you have a magistrate and making and demanding a jury.
Okay.
Article 3 court is a court of record. And go back and look at some of our paperwork. It's explained in the footnotes, in every one of the papers that John writes, in the memorandums, in the footnotes. He'll say, in this Article 3, in this court of record, and it's all explained in there. If you read that paper and then go down and read the footnotes, you're going to understand what Article 3 court means because it's documented in there what it means. All the authorities for that are in there. And you want to make sure you put your authorities in there because, you know, that way they can't come back later and say they didn't know. You know what I mean? Or you didn't protest. So anyway, I think that's, you know, the long and the short of it there.
And the other thing is I'm still tossing around. The thing I struggle with is that is the fee to go to federal court, you know. I keep asking, why do I have to pay to defend myself against unlawful and unconstitutional charges? And it just seems, and the fee is not, it's $400. It's not a small amount, you know. And I just feel like that is, I just feel like everything is set up for companies. and that there's nothing for we the people. It's all oriented towards like big money with companies, and it's
absolutely,
like we have
because they want to operate in equity. They want to operate, you know, like a military court. And so you're right. You shouldn't have to pay, and that should always be part of your. That should be part of your damages or your wherefore clauses to get that money back.
Yeah, it's like the people have been edited out of the process.
Absolutely.
You know.
Absolutely.
And
you're right.
But yet they're all paid with taxpayer money. You know, and I'm like, you know what? This is just ridiculous.
Yeah, well, that's a whole other battle right there. But you can make that battle inside of your battle. But, you know, they're money hungry, follow the money. They're all making money all along the way here. They're making money in ways you haven't even figured out yet. So
That's the problem I had. Mine is a code enforcement case, as you know. And that's the problem I had with them, is everything they have is like oriented towards the companies, you know, and they don't have anything set up to protect the people.
No, well, this is a problem. It is a problem, and it's something that we're going to have to work on, because they've just basically taken the tables and turned them on us. But anyway, I want to get moving along here, because I still got five people, and I want to try to get them through.
So thank you so much.
Yeah, go back in the archives and study that and look at some of the cases. You'll be surprised what you pull out, okay?
All right, out here.
Yeah, bye-bye. Okay, next caller. I don't have a name. I have a 718 area code. Can you hear me? Hello, hello. Is anybody there? Okay, they disappeared. Hang on. Okay.
Hi, Baird.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, thanks. And thanks for staying late for everyone. I invited a lot of YouTube video producers onto the call tonight because I wanted to ask about the situation that's happening with class actions for our First Amendment rights. As you probably are aware, there's a QAnon phenomenon going on across the country, and there has been an indication that we should do class action lawsuits because these YouTubers that have, some of them have 50 or 100,000, some have more than, some have a million followers, and those sites, YouTube, Twitter, Google is disappearing their search efforts.
I'm very familiar with what's going on, because some of the channels I watch got removed, so I'm not very happy about it, you know.
Right.
By the way, what's your first name and what state are you from?
My name is Linda. I'm from Massachusetts. I'm the Committee of Safety person here, and I have the seal, and we do the backup for our state. However, I have to tell you right off the bat, for anyone listening, if anything falls apart in your state, do not come to Massachusetts, because these people are in for a whirlwind. They're all glued to CNN. There's nobody to talk to. Thank you for being here.
I'm laughing, but it's not funny. It really isn't. I mean, I know Massachusetts. I'm right across the border in New York, so I'm familiar.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I talk to the New Hampshire Committee of Safety people, the Maine Committee of Safety people. We stick together, but I'll tell you, if things go bad, I will leave all of the documentation so that they can rebuild their committee, but I am out of here. It will not be pretty. So with that, what I'm wondering, and we've been on for, you know, almost 3 hours, so I'm hoping that they stayed on, but I'll take a clip of this part of the audio just in case. But anyway, I invited those YouTube video makers here so that we could find out about if these private companies if we're being told to do a class action suit, many class action suits.
Well, I know there's a couple of YouTubers that are helping the younger guys, and they're setting up a class action. Class actions give me a rash, because the trouble with class actions, I have a bad taste in my mouth. Every class action suit that I was ever close to or knew about, it seems at the end of the day, the attorneys get all the money and the people get nothing. So it's like, and they drag it out, You don't have to do a class action. You can do a suit where other people sign in to it with you. You know,
all right.
And we should
discuss
that.
Would
that
be an Article 3?
I wouldn't do anything else but an Article 3 on any of this stuff, because I mean you want to go into a Nisi Prius court, that's an administrative court, and it should, you want a constitutional court. This is a constitutional issue too, and it does need to be in the federal court as far as that goes, and it's definitely First Amendment. To me it's a no brainer. It should be to any jury, no doubt, you know. And just because they're a private company, they are providing a service that the public is depending on, like the electric company, and it's a monopoly. So by virtue of those things, people depending on them for information and communication and all these things, and they're claiming that it's a free and open forum, and then all of a sudden they come in and they start doing censorship. That doesn't work like that. You know what I mean?
So is there a way that we can automate the process? Because QAnon is basically saying do class action suits to drown them in the suit. So
yeah, well,
I'm
the trouble is you need a bunch of lawyers to do class action. You know what
so
I mean?
Could we set up a template for Article 3, repeat,
well,
repeat it?
Yeah, I don't know, in that particular, you look at our stuff, you see what we put into the court as an Article 3. You have to have, that, all that information on the front page. You look at any paperwork we write, and that's how you set up an Article 3 court when you go into the, you can modify that for your case. Now, how you bring other people in and sign them in and have them do, in order for them to enter a case, they should do an affidavit. They should have it, and they should have it sworn, through a notary.
Right.
And I think you could. I think I joined Bob Schultz's case against the IRS through We the People, and that was like a class action, but it wasn't a class action. I signed it. I filled out the affidavit and signed the form, and I went and he collected the paperwork and put it in a file, and that's the way you do it. You collect all these people, and look, we have the form for filling out an affidavit, and what you do
yep.
is you do an affidavit of how they wronged you, and
yep.
why,
yep.
And then your name goes in the suit that way. I'm not an attorney. I can't give legal advice as far as class action. I'm just giving you my experience with class action was never very good. I didn't have anything good to say about it. You end up getting a $1.26 check at the end of 10 years. You know what I mean? But and it seems like they drag it out because they're making money. But anyway, it does hurt. Look, I'm not saying they don't work though.
That's what I'm wondering, because a lot of people will not.
Yes.
People will be interested in doing this process, but they won't be interested in paying the fees of attorneys and coming out with whatever. So I'm wondering if it would have the same effect as QAnon's really talking about class action.
Absolutely, because that suit they have to answer, and the more people that go in and do it, the it does hurt them, and it's the same difference. They have to answer. Was that Terry? Was that you trying to say something?
Yeah, I was just wondering if you could use the model that John has done by filing one case, and then everybody attaches to that case. Does that
right,
apply?
Yeah.
That's what I'm talking about, because that's the way we do them. And the way you attach to that case is you do an affidavit, and it's a sworn statement, and that affidavit goes into the case with your name, and then you get listed in the box of defendants, he's got to print up all the defendants. There could be thousands of you as far as that goes, you know?
And so what, when I go onto your website, if you were to pick the best example for me to mimic, what case would it be and what would I find it under?
Well, our master case is basically like that. You know what I mean? The big case that we have where we've noticed Congress and everybody. That's a case that we came in kind of as the grand jury, and we have a couple of cases where we went to federal court. You got to set that. It's just a normal case. It's no different than filing a federal case. But like Terry says, you file that one case, and then the people attached to it, you go in as a plaintiff on it. Your name gets put in there, and you file an affidavit. And we'll talk to John about maybe setting something up for this particular thing, because this is a big issue, you know, with Google and YouTube, who owns, you know, they're all a monopoly. They're all been bought out. They're all owned by the same people, you know?
Right. Yeah. So it really, it could be, it's huge amounts of people. And so that's what I'm wondering about, the mimicking thing. So maybe I could talk to John during the week. And then the last piece of this that I just don't know, and I'm wondering if you have insights to share with anyone if they're still on the line, and that is the recent executive order that went through, and they're doing all of the Illuminati by military courts and all that crap. Has that changed anything in terms of the court doing court right now? Has it changed anything for the real person going in? Are we on maritime law? We know we want Article 3, so I get that part.
No, it hasn't changed anything for us going into the court. Only thing is because in his executive order, he declared that we were in a state of emergency.
Right.
And that was into those particular people and places and things that were going on where he could actually use a military tribunal on them because it's a state of emergency. But, you know, our case, you know, I don't want to say it's a state of emergency. Well, it might as well be, you know what I mean? But no, that doesn't affect us as far as us going into an Article 3 court. I think it's a good time to go in because I think they're going to be, they don't even realize what he did yet. They're so stupid. Maybe they do now. You know what I mean? You're going to start seeing a bunch of people flee on this whole business because stage two of it is happening now. And once they realize what's going on, a lot of them are going to run for the hills, so to speak, or look to plea bargain out or whatever they do. But that the only thing that's going to affect us is it might make it better for us going in because these judges are going to have to behave themselves. Because they're going to be watched now, you know what I mean? What they're doing, and in light of the Constitution, I think it's a great time to file a lawsuit in federal court. You know, I mean,
because they're all so scrambling.
Exactly, scared. And they have to. And look, you're going to hold their feet to the fire. Article 3, Constitution. You know, got to be loving it. Imagine, you know, thousands and thousands of suits coming in. Article 3, and this is the way it's done. And we want our magistrates, and we want our juries. And you know, this could be the start of a good thing. So you don't have to worry about any kind of military tribunal. You know, that's for these people that are doing all this international stuff across borders and lines and treasonous things that he's going after with, you know, pedophilia and all kinds of crazy stuff that they do up there. And this is designed for them. I mean, look at the first, you know, whatever, how many thousands of indictments that he did on the people that were running the rat lines that were running the drugs and the kids that were supplying them with the money. So he's basically taken their money base out by taking the lower people out that supply them with the money.
And in the stage process, it's a very interesting thing to watch this unravel.
It was genius. They didn't even know what he was doing. He's going after these people in foreign countries and taking them out. You know, I dare say that even some of these people involved in these rat lines of drugs and child trafficking and stuff, they probably didn't even know who those players were down there that was doing their dirty work. So when they saw some foreign name in there, they didn't realize that that's the name of the guy that's taking care of their business. You know what I mean?
That's right. And how about auditing the Pentagon and auditing the number of employees we're paying for? That is amazing. So it is an amazing thing. And much of the time when I talk about the issues that that we work on, I talk with other cause members and committees of safety members, and we're really preparing to, after the fall apart, we're getting down to the states and the state people, and the courts are crumbling. If you listen to Karen Houdes, she last week was just talking about how the courts are crumbling in the states. So it'll be a time, and then we will need to know this stuff. And it will, I think, is a great opportunity for you guys, for all of us, to get a little notoriety so that the American people know who we are. The information here is incredibly important. And also, last week, I was just listening to your recording from last week, and I wanted to make a note of how important it was to realize that you had paperwork that you had to send to every county, and it was $4,900. And on that recording, when I heard that, I was like, wow, hold on. That's right. The copies, the process, the payments, the stamps, $4,900. And that was a little thing you were talking about last week. And no wonder you are really imploring your members to at least give $5 so that you can buy stamps and paperwork, and just do what you're requested. So I wanted to take a moment to say I have absolute respect for the fact that you bring that up. And I hope this, because we're talking about people that actually we rely on for news on YouTube, and they're going down, and I'm going to have no news. I'm really pissed about this. You can't,
because you can't. What are you going to do? Watch CNN? That's ridiculous. No, I mean, nobody's watching CNN now. They're like a ghost town, but they're so arrogant. And look, people need to know how to do websites and put their videos on their own websites. It's not going to be It's not going to be as nice or as accessible as YouTube would. But like I subscribe to some of them, and one of the guys is saying, look, get on my email list. Yeah. So that I can email you any latest news, so they're not losing touch, they won't be able to go and take videos off of their sites, you know, when you go. So if you got a guy that you know is pretty good with fleshing out the news, there's a couple of them out there that are really good. At least try to keep track of him and join his website, and share videos yourself. I mean, people are setting up other tubes. But,
BitChute and DTube is really, they're going to see a huge growth. Also, I'd like to mention for your listeners, especially Committee of Safety members, if you're building a Committee of Safety, look into some cryptocurrency, because I follow money as a hobby. And that is a really important issue, not only for each committee member to know about for rebuilding their towns, but also local banks. And if anyone's listening and you have not looked at local banks yet, there's a really good chance we might need that as things progress. I mean, now we're talking maybe a year or two. So we'll be done this freedom of speech issue. Whatever is going to happen will probably be done before the money falls, if we're lucky.
It's hard to say, though, because things...
It is hard to say.
Things could be... You can get into cascading cross defaults, and it could all end tomorrow. And
yes.
I would say that people need to get into gold and silver more than cryptocurrencies, because look at cryptos. They're only going to let them be out there as long as they want them. I mean, the only reason they're out there and they're anonymous right now is because ultimately... The government wants to go into a cashless crypto society, and they like that blockchain technology. And I think the only reason they let it go this far is because ultimately it's going to lead us away from cash.
So the central bank, right?
Right.
Right.
And so, somehow they're going to keep that central finger in there, because if they control the crypto and they can track it, You know, they claim that it's anonymous, but that's baloney. There's nothing that in digital world that can't be tracked. Believe me, the NSA knows.
Right. Yeah. Well, I'll make the argument just for the entertainment, mental entertainment, that yes, that is true that they can track it, but they're not releasing all the money themselves. Some of it is being released by private entities.
Right. Nevertheless, if you have junk silver and stuff like that, that's what you're going to barter with in your communities. That's going to be very important. Real money, hard money, and even rice and beans. Look at, you can trade any commodity that's a real commodity is going to be worth something when the money goes down. It's going to be worth more than the money is. You'll be paper your walls with the money, you know. So
yeah, right.
So you want those hard goods. But anyway, we'll continue this on. I don't have much time. I'm going to try to get to somebody else here. But I'll talk to John about this whole Internet thing, this First Amendment suit that should go on. And there's other people out there that you need to network with and find out who's doing what, you know, so you're not duplicating your efforts.
Well, that was the goal for this night, to know whether Article 3 could be used with with the template and affidavit.
Absolutely. And we should try to get a hold of John in between now and next Monday and kind of like expand upon that more. But we're we're over midnight now, so.
Yeah. Good night. Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you very much. Oh, everybody, I'm sorry I ran out of time. And we'll see you here next week, same time, same bat station. And hopefully we can pick up where we left off. Thank you very much. Have a good night.
Thank you.
God bless. Yep.